secret shared. Little off guard and unprepared.
Say You'll Haunt Me from Stone Sour, our brand new number one song. That's it for us today on the Sideshow Countdown. We'll see you next week with more of the biggest songs in rock, handpicked songs by me. I'm Nikki Sixx.
I'm Carrie Kasem.
See you next weekend.
The Sideshow is now over. Go ahead, stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
Now.
101.WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Julene.
All right, thank you very much. What a show we got. Hi, Julene Jordan.
Hi, Peter.
Why? Are you ready to rock?
Very much so. Rested and ready.
Do you do that? I haven't done this in a long time. We'd go out on personal appearances, like particularly the big venues, like what was then Pine Now became DTE.
Yeah.
You just get up on stage and you go, "Hey, Detroit, are you ready to rock?"
Well, in fact, I did it about 3 weeks ago, bringing Mitch Ryder on stage.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, they go, "Yeah," and then they say, "Detroit, I can't hear you."
Yeah. I want to tell you though, that Hamtramck Labor Day Festival rocks. You don't have to pull anything out of anyone because those people are into it.
All right, we've got a ton of stuff to talk about. Healthcare, Obamacare coming in. Bishop Eddie Long having some trouble down there in Georgia.
Oh, is
we'll talk
he
about
ever?
That. Any number of other things. There's lots of demonstrations coming up here and in Washington. I want to tell you about them. The one in Washington, the big one on October 2nd, next Saturday, got some scholarships available if you want to take a bus. By the way, we are a phone-in talk show, and our number is 313-298-WRIF, which is
313-298-9743.
Yes. And if you'd like to email us, if the lines are filled, which they are not now, you can email us. Or if you're bashful, call talkyes@yahoo.com. We are on Facebook at facebook.com/nightcall and friends always wanted. Thank you to Debbie. We never say her last name. Debbie, if you're listening, she is. She always listens.
Yes.
If you want full credit, let us know.
Okay. Well, she also posted a bunch of really great articles
this week
on the Facebook. And thank you, Debbie.
Yeah. And so, you can grab a lot of this stuff there. Stephanie is at the phone.
She is, and she brought us muffins. And what we like phone screeners who bring us healthy muffins.
Yeah. And I just...
Thanks, Stephanie.
Wow, man. I feel kind of weird all of a sudden.
No.
Oh. Man, I'm getting this echo from... What's going on here?
She's in there, I'm sure, hollering at you. It's too soundproof to hear her.
Yeah, that ever happened to you?
No.
Long ago and far away, I had literally some brownies, right? I go, nice chocolate little treat.
Sure.
And then my wife and I went to a movie. And all of a sudden, the screen started doing the weirdest stuff.
Really?
Yeah, this is... It's a
long time ago, right?
Yeah. Pretty far, yeah. I mean, it wasn't last week or anything.
No.
And all of a sudden, we both realized we had magic brownies. And sometimes that's really terrible to do. I mean, because some people can totally freak out.
Absolutely.
But since I had experimented in... Successfully with marijuana in college, that showed you the value of scientific experiments.
Right? It sure does.
Well, let's see. Where in the world should we start? Actually, let's go. Well, you know what? Let's go from the absurd to the necessary. My wife is a big fan of Dancing with the Stars, mm-hmm. which probably almost everybody knows is this sort of dance contest. They have these professional dancers that pair up with,
of all
sort of
different
B-list types. Stars. And they've always got somebody odd on there from, like, what was that Republican they had on there, that one of those criminals?
We forget.
That's indicted. It's nice. It's nice that we can.
Yeah.
But anyway, they have Bristol Palin, Sarah's daughter.
I saw it. It was a vomit-inducing.
Well, I saw her, and she was, you know, these women really wear the sexiest outfits,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they are something else.
Like, my wife's always saying, how do they stay on? You know, it's tape.
That's right.
I think it's some kind of sticky stuff,
yeah,
to be sure.
Yeah.
But she was just dressed up. She looked like almost like a Muslim woman, right?
At
the beginning. And I thought, oh, this poor woman. They told her she can't, you know, throw it around or be real sexy.
They made her look conservative.
Very, very conservative. Everything but a headscarf, actually.
Yeah, right.
And all of a sudden, the music starts. She gets out there, and she whips this off, and she's got this short red dress on, and she's shaking her booty.
My eyes about popped out of my head. It was awful.
And the only thing that no one mentioned, I don't know anything about the partners, but they kind of freeze right at the end in the last step, and this guy just gets a handful of Bristol Palin butt and just freezes there, and Sarah was not in the audience, which probably, Stephanie says Bristol Palin looked really clumsy, which is true, but I'll tell you, Stephanie, a lot of these people that my wife tells me that over the months of the competition get better and better.
Yeah.
And better.
Yeah.
She's not.
Yeah. I was hoping she'd be out.
Yeah, well, because one of these days, Sarah's going to pop in.
Biggest ratings ever, probably.
Yeah. I mean, Sarah, a little understandable how she came to the public for, but Bristol is certainly just famous for being famous. Famous for being pregnant, I guess.
Yeah, and the daughter of Sarah pregnancy thing,
I guess,
for sure.
I guess famous people, their kids are famous as well. All right. A little bit of the brand new healthcare stuff came into play. And so what in the world do we make of it? It's a little tough because I started seeing all the sort of the network news coverage, and it was all very positive. A lot of it doesn't even, some of it doesn't even click into like 2019 and 2014 and 2019. But in the Associated Press, medical writer Carla K. Johnson, healthcare kicks into second gear. What the hell is first? Does it help me?
Was just getting it passed, I think. Wasn't
I guess,
it?
Yeah. Free preventative care. That's pretty excellent, right? So people can get colonoscopies and breast screening and stuff like that.
Important stuff.
Yeah. They've abolished lifetime limits because these bandit health insurance companies would say, you've got $600,000 and then, you're out of here. Now you can't do that.
They just keep getting worse and worse from what I understand insured folks out there.
And for annual limits, they cannot be lower than $750,000, and they'll now be eliminated entirely by 2014. Children, the adult children up till age 26 can be under their parents' plan. So this, I thought, this is all pretty cool. Are these changes likely to raise health insurance premiums? Well, the companies have already begun raising them. And the Obama administration says the new benefits will raise premiums by no more than 1% to 2%. Benefit consulting companies say the impact will be in the single digits, but may vary from plan to plan. So I thought, okay, that's pretty cool. It's pretty hard for any of us to understand it and how it is going to, what impact it's going to have on any of us.
And where's the but?
Yeah, well, no but. Oh, the but in that I looked, and of course all the right wingers are going crazy, and something called, is it the San Francisco, maybe it's the San Francisco Examiner.
Yeah, I think it is.
Yeah. Without reading everything, Obamacare is even worse than critics thought, and it just goes down this list how it's going to, they say it's going to cover elective abortions, whereas Obama said it wouldn't. It said it won't decrease health care costs for the government. According to Medicare's actuary, it will increase costs. On the other hand,
is this a study or what?
I don't know. See, I mean, we don't know. I mean, and if I said I did know, and if I made this like an exhaustive study, I would go into it with the prejudice that this is something we wanted and needed, because we're the only industrial country without a full medical care for absolutely everyone. But so in many ways, we're going to have to wait and see. I mean, to go right out of the chute with it's really bad. I mean, and that's part of the Republican program that they just launched. They actually say they stand for something other than just the party of no. So one of the things they want to do is roll back or eliminate this health plan completely. Well, how do the American people feel? Well, it turns out the majority of people are dissatisfied with it. And the Republicans think, see, you know, we were right. They the people don't like it. They don't want it. They want to leave it up to the free market. And those tens of millions of people that don't have any are okay with it. And those tens of millions of people more that have really crappy insurance. So probably maybe like 100 million people with really bad health insurance that even if they got anything more than kind of a cold, they could face bankruptcy. So it turns out, though, in this report, that although the health care overhaul has divided the nation, and Republicans believe their call for repeal will help them in, help them win elections in November, they say here the picture isn't clear. A new AP poll finds that Americans who think the law should have done more, outnumber those who think the government should stay out of health care by 2-1.
Wow.
In other words, if anything is going wrong with it, for instance, that in premiums would rise or something like that, it's because even within this limited health care reform, which is probably the weakest now of all the industrial countries, not number one, but number 17 or number 19 or something like that, the best health, what do you say, the best health care, yeah, the best health care of the industrialized nation, the worst in health system.
Absolutely.
Of the industrial.
Because we have the technology. We have.
Yeah, so many people are excluded from it. So by a margin of 2-1, people think that it should have been done more. Like there was going to be what was called a public option, which would compete with these private firms, not on an unfair basis, but stop the unfair raising of premiums that have made these healthcare companies absolutely wealthy and to the point where they can affect elections by the millions that they give to the politicians that will do their bidding. Brian Braley, 49, a tech industry worker from Mesa, Arizona, wants Washington to keep its hands off. I think it's a Trojan horse. I wonder, do people
like
understand that?
I like the ignorant voice.
Yeah. But do people know that? Sometimes I wonder, you know, we take a lot of phrases for granted. What a Trojan horse. I mean, there's probably a whole generation of people that just...
We used to always look these things up.
Well, no. I mean, I think it's about condoms or something
Trojan, yeah.
Yeah, Trojan
That's
horse.
A brand,
That's a brand
yeah.
name. No, but that was in Troy where, I don't know, whoever they were fighting. Just check your last movie about all that. They brought all the soldiers in this huge horse. So that was it. But anyway, Braley said of the health care law, it's a communist socialist scheme. All the other countries have tried this. They're billions in debt, and they admit this doesn't work. This guy's a moron. I mean, the opposite is true. Some of the countries are stressed financially. Hey, hello, there's a worldwide economic crisis. And one of the reasons that that some of these countries are having problems, like Britain, to some extent like Canada, because they're spending all this money on their military,
yes,
which they don't need. I mean, does Britain really need a nuclear program? Does it really need to be the U.S.'s junior, imperial guard?
Ultimately, no, but they've pissed off so many countries.
Yeah, maybe they should. So, in any event, I think the question is still open about how this is all going to work. I mean, what we really need is a single-payer universal health plan that that covers everybody. I think there's a good chance, for instance, the Supreme Court will say that it's unconstitutional to require every person to obtain health insurance.
Agreed.
Yeah. I mean, that's never happened before. It's in what they call the Commerce Clause of the Constitution that the federal government has the right to regulate commerce. But, you know, we have a very, very far right wing court led by these far right wing conservatives, balanced only slightly by these moderates, the Democrats. You get that? when it's time for the Democrats to elect somebody to the Supreme Court, they appoint a centrist. And then and things have skewed so far to the right in the public discourse, not so much among the people, but in the public discourse that's carried out by the media. These people are seen as left of center. Well, they're not. They're centrists. And then when the Republicans, when they nominate somebody, it's these far right wingers. Okay. So, short of repeal, this article says, the GOP, I wonder if people even know what that means. A lot of people. GOP. What's the GOP?
The Grand Old Party.
Yeah, yeah. Although, oh, that's GOP. Well, chip at the House with a health law. So the Republicans, if they get any numbers of seats in the congressional election, they're developing plans to try to repeal or roll back President Obama's new health care law. Now, does anybody out there, I mean, even you Republicans, think that these guys that are the representatives of the ultra-rich and everything they want really care about your health? I mean, all right, Democrats ain't a great, you don't want to write a whole grand congratulations to them or anything like that.
By any means.
And a lot of them are in the pocket of the corporations
sure
as well,
are.
But not to the extent of the Republicans. I mean, they don't make any bones about it. Their agenda is 100% corporate. Corporate rule and screw you. And some of you are out there voting for them, mouthing their talking points. That's really pathetic, I got to tell you. I mean, these rich people laugh at you. They really do. They wouldn't let you in the door. They let you in the side door, you know, to
clean their house
or fix their pipes or do something like that.
Yeah.
But, they've got their own agenda. So, and you are just cannon fodder for it. You know, you are the dog meat of their.
Peter, you're riled up tonight. Yeah.
All right. So, some calls on that, 313-298-WRIF. Got a number of people that want to talk about the health care already. But Scott and Stan and Dale, you hang on because we have to just take a little aside here and here. No, that's the wrong one.
You tried so hard.
I tried so
what
hard.
What track is it, Peter? You want me to cue it up for you?
You're
on the CD.
I got it. That was a CD here.
There we go.
There we go.
Okay.
Another one bites the dust. And another one goes. And another one goes. Another one bites the dust. Hey. Another one bites the dust.
It just keeps happening, Peter.
It does. Bishop Eddie Long down in Atlanta.
Bishop Eddie Long in Atlanta, the mega church that has one of the biggest congregations in the country.
25,000 people.
25,000 people. And he built this thing from nothing.
Yeah.
He drives Bentleys. He
a
has
Bentley?
Bodyguards. He has a Bentley.
You know what a Bentley is?
It's a very expensive
It's a Rolls Royce.
Vehicle.
With a different grill.
Oh.
So the people that don't want to look real ostentatious.
Yeah.
But it costs like a minimum of $150,000.
Oh, absolutely.
If you have a shower in it.
What?
That's
no.
An old joke.
Okay, Peter.
You got me out of the shower for that.
It's not in the dictionary.
Yeah.
Now, this guy is also very homophobic. In fact, he held that huge rally in Washington.
Atlanta.
It was in Atlanta, rather.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
He had a march. Let's not call it huge. It was a big march in Atlanta against gay marriage and against homosexuality. So I asked somebody that worked here. I said, guess what happened? He said, he got outed as a gay. I said, well, you're close.
Ding, 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 ding.
You're close. Four young men have said that Bishop Eddie Long, in fact, had enticed them into homosexual relationships, promising them and giving them
vehicles, lodging, all kinds of things. Took them on trips.
Yeah.
You know?
In fact, if you have, and the only people, there's some hardcore, just mean-spirited homophobes. But there's a number of people that have religious opposition or religious resistance to gay relations.
Yeah.
Well, but by now, these people that lead this are so discredited that it ought to make, you know, you a little nervous, too, if you're in that boat.
Right, absolutely.
Because if you say, I hate gays, I mean, if you say that, people, like, immediately must think you're gay.
Well, it's so true, Peter.
Are you against gay marriage? Yes. Well, you must be gay.
I mean, or at least you have some thoughts.
Yeah, right.
Your private little thoughts, you know they're there.
It's because the more vociferous these anti-gay Christians are,
the
more gay they are.
Now, these guys were all above the legal age of consent, but still, he had this group. What was it? A boys group, young men's group that he mentored them, and he had ceremonies where they said vows together, and this is just sick.
Yeah.
Now, let's also talk about his muscle shirts. He's a big bodybuilder. He wears flashy gold jewelry and wears muscle shirts. And he sent pictures. If you just go to the Google, folks, and enjoy the picture of is it Reverend Bishop Eddie Long? And he's got
muscle shirts.
He's sending his muscle shirt pictures, kind of posing in the mirror to these young men.
Yeah.
And he's married twice, married now, father of four, thinks that all the gay people should go live on an island or maybe just not exist.
Yeah.
Oh, and his church also holds classes to convert people.
The gays.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, that doesn't work, Bishop Long.
And he's got a lot of charities. I mean, he does some good work in the community.
No, he started doing the charity work after he came under fire after this rally. That's when he started. He tried to clean up his image.
Oh, the other thing was he was being investigated because he's also got these businesses. And here, this is what I like. It says that Bishop Long today said, I feel like David against Goliath. Except the only thing is, man, you make $3 million salary.
That he does.
He's Goliath.
A pastor, a reverend, what bishop, who makes $3 million. Yeah, he is Goliath, Peter.
Yeah, let's go back.
Great point.
Let's go back to the muscle shirts.
Yeah, let's do.
Here, but first off, these are all alleged. Let's say that. We don't know for sure. But there is a bad history among right-wingers, which he is not. He's not a right-winger. His Coretta King's funeral was at his church.
Yeah,
although,
to which they pointed out, someone pointed out, she probably wouldn't be happy.
No, and, I can't remember who it was. The head of the NAACP at the time refused to go, saying that...
Julian Bond.
Julian Bond, right, who said that that both Coretta King, who supported gay rights, never would have had it there.
No, and MLK... Jr. Right. would be appalled by this. I'm sure of it because he was against any type of discrimination.
But here, there is an eloquent defense of his muscle shirts.
I bet.
Of Reverend Long's, by his attorney, Craig Gillen. The photos don't corroborate these charges. Bishop Long is a health advocate. He's a weightlifter. He's a fella, you know, who's going to go to work and he's going to have on a muscle shirt and he's gone, you know, he may show up in church, in a muscle shirt. And I know, sure, he can come. He comes down to my office in a muscle shirt. So, there's nothing really in those photographs that seems to me, in any way that, is corroborative of these allegations.
Exactly, quote unquote, Peter.
Yeah.
And first of all, that he needs to fire this guy immediately.
I was going to say, here's some free advice, Bishop Eddie.
Yeah, fire this guy because, you know, he's not real smooth in the courtroom, clearly.
Wow. Let me see. What else? Is there anything in here? But as I've been saying all along, I mean, what is up with these Republicans? I thought maybe we actually have a hypocritical Democrat. Yeah, that maybe he was big in the Democratic Party. It turns out he supports politicians of both parties.
He's a social conservative, they say.
Yeah, well, if you're anti-gay, that same thing. His message is that God wants people to prosper.
Yeah, it's this money thing because he wants his congregation to be okay with all the dough he makes, man.
All right, listen. That is...
Here it is, Peter.
What?
He favors Gucci sunglasses, gold necklaces, diamond bracelets, and Rolex watches. He lives in a 5,000-square-foot home with five bedrooms, which he bought for $1.1 million in 2005.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, here's what I think. Yeah, well... When I start thinking about the existence of God, churches, and all that, I was just reading this about just about astronomy. And there's approximately 100 million galaxies. Now, somebody, I don't know, you can do this in your head, or you may need a paper and pencil for this one, because I was trying to figure this out. Yeah, look, you see all these figures on the back of the paper?
Yeah.
I couldn't do it. But there's 100 million galaxies, right? And we live in a galaxy called the Milky Way. It's estimated that in our galaxy alone, there are 50 billion stars. Okay?
Yeah.
There's 100 million galaxies with 50 billion stars. I don't know if this is correct, but let's take that as an average. What is 50 billion times 100 million? I gave up. I couldn't do it.
You don't have a calculator?
I don't think they
have
that.
It doesn't go into billions.
Billions? That's all got to be over quintillions.
Right.
So there's that many stars, which by another name is known as suns, right?
Yeah.
Around these suns are planets. Mm-hmm. So there's hundreds and thousands and thousands and thousands of billions of suns with trillions and trillions of planets, which must have some life. So why in the world a God would create all this is so far beyond me. I mean, if you got stories, you tell yourself stories, anything works. But it was before when people first made up all this stuff, because there seems to be a universal, a cultural universal that people have spiritual beliefs. I mean, there's a few people they found, but almost 99% of every people they've ever discovered on Earth had some spiritual belief mm-hmm. or other. So all these other people got it wrong, the stone axe gods and the gods in the tree trunk and all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
That was all wrong. And suddenly, though, through these trillions of planets and all that, God spoke to this little tribe in the desert in the Middle East and said, "You are my chosen people." Does that make any sense to anybody? It doesn't.
It doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I mean,
look at it that way.
Talk about ethnocentric or planet-centric. What are all these other people?
There they go bashing religion again.
Yeah,
I can hear them, Peter.
Christopher Hitchens, who wrote a book called God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything, was diagnosed recently with esophageal cancer, the same disease that killed his father. He's fighting it, but I don't think his time is long. But he is still fighting for the atheist cause. And he was in Birmingham, Alabama. He's English, but he spends a lot of time in the United States. Mm-hmm. Might even be an American citizen now. And September 20th was informally proclaimed Everybody Pray for Hitchens Day. So these Christians that, like vultures, are saying, "Oh, man, now he's sick. Now he'll bend.
He'll see the ways.
And he said, Christopher Hitchens, according to this article, won't be bowing his head even on a day set aside just for him. In an interview, he said, "I shall not be participating."
Yeah.
He was diagnosed with cancer in June, and because he has a new memoir out called Hitch 22, a memoir. And Larry Taunton, a friend who heads an Alabama-based group dedicated to defending Christianity, said, "How's your health?" He said, "Well, I'm dying, since you asked, but so are you. I'm only doing it more rapidly."
Yeah, what a quote.
And let's see. He says the people praying for him break down into three basic groups. Those who seem genuinely glad he's suffering and dying from cancer, those who want him to become a believer in the religious faith, and those who are asking God to heal him. He said, the first group, "To hell with you," is the response, "the ones who pray for me to go to hell." He's ruling out the idea of a deathbed change of heart. Thanks, but no thanks. I mean, I would say, if there is a God, I've never seen any evidence or even have any reason to suspect there is, I would think he's merciful. I mean, I try with my intellect the best. Am I supposed to listen to some whack job right winger who tells me I'm going to go to hell unless I accept everything he says as human being? What would make me even suspect that this jerk off would be correct, right?
Yeah.
Then I know all the good Christians and Jews and Muslims and Buddhists and Buddhists. I don't think Buddhists are pretty atheistic.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah. Any one of those, I would say to them, "Hey, I just don't believe. It's not in me. There's nothing there. I'm not even sure Jesus even existed as an historical person."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've never seen any great amount of evidence. Am I going to go to hell? There's not a one of them would say, "Yes, you are going to." The fires of damnation will consume you.
It's just all fear-based.
Just creep. Yeah, it's a cosmic blackmail.
I just don't... personally, I just find that so offensive, but that's just me.
Did you say something about being stoned?
No.
Okay, good.
No.
Maybe it was that. Maybe
I'm
was
sure
that.
Someone out there is, though.
Well, maybe it was.
It's Michigan.
Yeah. You know, and I think every time I say that, you know, that religion has been the cause of so much violence. I was watching this movie called Agora. Do you know
Agora,
that?
Agora, I don't know that.
It's had a hard time getting distributed because the Christians are the bad folks in
freaking
this.
Freaking out?
Yeah. It's about the burning of the library at Alexandria in the 4th century.
Wow.
And these mobs of Christians break into this pagan temple that is the repository of all the learning of the old world and burn all the books because they say, you know, they're blasphemous.
Right.
And at the same time, of course, this is, you know, Christianity came to the fore because of Constantine, Constantine,
why not?
The Emperor Constantine and Augustine, the church father, who said that Jesus is not coming back soon, but the institution of the church is Christ incarnate, you know, so we're going to take care of you and we're going to, you know, create this whole body of worship that,
that leads into
That mirrors the Roman Empire. And Augustine, or Constantine, the emperor, said, okay, cool. And he converted, and they made paganism illegal. And
there was a lot of borrowing going on from cultures
all
back then. Yeah.
Anyway, Christopher Hitchens says, those that pray for him say, it's fine by me. I think of it as a nice gesture, and it may well make them feel better, which is a good thing in itself. But he says, prayers for his healing don't make him feel any better. Well, every day, everybody pray for Hitchens Day. I don't even know how that went off.
It's a little bizarre.
I'm sorry, and I mean this sincerely, from the depth of my heart. I do mean you think I'm going to be
cynical. Are you backtracking now?
No, I'm just going to say if I've offended anyone's feelings, I'm sorry about that.
Yeah. Okay.
And the idea, though, that I shouldn't speak my mind, which any liberal religionist would have no objection to and does not threaten their belief or their belief system in the slightest.
Or feel threatened by
yours. Or feel threatened by mine. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And who respect me, love me, in terms of people in my family and all that, regardless. And me too. Because these people, as I always say, would be the same. They'd be the same, the liberal and the good Christians and Jews and Muslims I know would still be tolerant and peaceful and loving and what have you.
Absolutely.
If you took away their religion. These right-wingers, they would still be mean-spirited and intolerant and warmongering, misogynist racists. Right?
that's a pretty heavy load there.
Right. You want me to tell you what I really think?
Yeah, you know, you really need to start stepping up a little, Peter.
I just want to do this one thing. I was going to go break, but let's stand. So I'm calling you out by name. Jeff and Dale and Stan and Scott, stay on the line. We're going to get you in a second. But Tim is calling in from Georgia, and I want to get him on the air. Hi, Tim. Thanks for calling. It's 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Pete. How you doing?
We're good.
Well, that's good to hear. Why don't we just cut it down to brass tacks? I mean, we talk about religion dividing us. We talk about all these things dividing us, and you're a right-winger, teabagger. But really, there's only two things dividing this nation is those who make money with their money and those who work for their labor.
There you go.
It for a wage.
There you go. That's it.
In a nutshell.
Yeah, I was figuring you could roll on that one.
Well, Tim, I don't know if you ever hear of the industrial workers of the world.
Yeah, the Wobblies?
The Wobblies, as they were called. No one exactly knows why. But the preamble to their Constitution says, written in 1905, I think, in Chicago, the working class and the employing class have nothing in common. And certainly in small businesses where bosses work right alongside of workers, oftentimes, not always, sometimes these guys are sons of bitches. I've certainly worked for them. Other times, you know, it's a cooperative effort in many ways, but it's the boss that works the hardest and has got the risk and all that. But the big companies, that sure is true. They don't care about their workers. They don't care about the communities. They have no identification of themselves and their company, their companies, rather, as even being American anymore. And they have declared class war upon us a long time ago, and we still, many of us, I shouldn't say we, many of us still have allegiance to them. I don't understand. All right, Tim, I see on the board here it says you wanted to talk about the rally in Washington, D.C. On Saturday.
You know it. That, there is a perfect statement where us workers can get together.
You going there?
And I'll be there. Yeah, I made plans a month ago.
Great.
Well, that is good. All right, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to say thank you, and I do have to get to these commercials, and I'll tell people about this March on Washington. You can also go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. That'll give you all the information as well. And also, as I said, there are scholarships available from Detroit if you want to take a bus. In other words, they'll pay for you. So information on that when we come back. I'm pressing all the wrong buttons tonight, aren't I?
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werbe and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Time's running out. You're maxed out on your credit cards. The collection calls are coming every day, and now you're two payments behind on your mortgage. Every time you turn on the radio, there's some cheerful couple telling you how they got out of debt overnight. Their stress is gone, and everything's just wonderful. Come on. The truth is, what sounds too good to be true is too good to be true. You need real help, and you need it now. Not bankruptcy. That should be your last choice. We're Credit Card Relief, and we've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. We're the attorney-driven program, dedicated to helping you get out of debt in months instead of years, saving you thousands, and without risking your family home. We know what we're doing, and we don't make promises we can't keep. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Get out of debt. Call Credit Card Relief at 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. That's Credit Card Relief. 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282. If you want a new computer but think you can't get credit, think again. Just call Tronics Country right now. No matter what your credit status is, now you can own a brand new desktop or laptop computer. Your approval is guaranteed as long as you have an active checking account and can afford small weekly payments. With Tronics Country, there's no credit check. You will not be turned down. Call right now and order your new computer. You'll also get a free color printer and a free digital camera. Just call 800-990-2258. But that's not all. Call right now and you'll also get a free 22-inch high-definition TV with your paid purchase. You heard right. A free TV with your new computer. All you need is an active checking account and your approval is guaranteed. Don't wait. Call Tronics Country right now. Call 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werbe and Jolene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much and welcome back. We'll get to your calls in just a second. And this is from the New York Times today. What is today? Is today the 26th? Today's the 26th,
yes.
Right. This in the New York Times, hoping to overshadow last month's rally led by Glenn Beck that drew thousands of teabaggers. It says Tea Party, but I call them teabaggers. and other conservatives, a coalition of liberal groups planned to descend on Washington on Saturday to make the case that they and not the ascendant right speak for America's embattled middle class. The only reason, it's going to take me about 4 hours to get through this thing, I think, this article. The right is not ascendant. What has happened? There has been this mobilization of this small grouping on the far right, and it has gotten so much media play that everybody jibber-jabbers about it. It becomes the focal point of dialogue on politics in this country.
Yeah, it's like water cooler talk now. You know?
How many times have I got to make this analogy? The teabaggers have a convention in Nashville a few months ago. 600 people show up. The left has a convention, essentially, called the United States Social Forum in Detroit in June. Of course, none of you heard anything about it because the media didn't cover it hardly at all. 20, and actually it wasn't, that's an exaggeration, 15, I think they've been scaling it down, 15 to 20,000,
okay.
Let's say, 15 to 20,000 people show up in Detroit, and it's not the ascendant left, right? All right. Predicting a crowd of hundreds of thousands, some 300 liberal groups, including the AFL-CIO, the National Council of La Raza, the NAACP, the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, are sponsoring a march on Saturday of hope in hope of transforming the national conversation so it focuses less on the Tea Party. Well, the reason, I mean, that's up to the media. I mean, they don't consider They do not consider the left very exciting to to focus. And as I always say, 600 people, there's more. There'll be more people at the Port-a-Johns on Saturday waiting to take a pee and a poop than there were in Nashville among these tea baggers. I probably just should say take a pee, right? It's called One Nation Working Together. You can find out all about this, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, or One Nation Working Together. Say they hope to supplant, well, all this does is talk about the baggers. All right. The New York SEIU has chartered 500 buses to carry 25,000 union members to the rally. With so many civil rights, labor, religious, student, gay, and peace groups sponsoring the march, organizers acknowledge it was not easy to forge a common platform, blah, 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 like that. But this is going to be quite an incredible place to be. I'm not going to be there. You're not going either, are you?
I'm not able to go do work.
Yeah, that's right. Me too. So I'm not going. I was trying to figure out a way, just couldn't do it. There's buses going from Detroit, and the group putting it together is the Detroit Area Peace with Justice Network. And you can call them at 248-548-3920, 248-548-3920. That might be particularly useful for you if you don't have the money to go for the buses. The buses are $70 a person, but there are scholarships available.
Yeah.
So, and from what I understand,
that's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, there's $900 for scholarships. So what does that mean? 10, 12, something like that.
Great.
Did we ever get anybody ever give us a figure on the 100 billion galaxies with 50 billion stars
in it? No one.
I figured that through. But this is here. Many sponsors say the rally is not seeking to back President Obama or the Democrats, but rather to hold all of Washington, Democrats and Republicans, accountable for not doing more to fix the nation's problems. Some sponsors sound unmistakably partisan as they denounce obstructionism in the Senate that has blocked larger job creation programs and other measures. Let's see. I thought there was somewhere where there was this list of what all this was about. Extend unemployment benefits, raise the minimum wage, end the foreclosure epidemic, enact legislation making it easier to join unions, increase infrastructure spending to create jobs, fix our broken immigration system, a lot of stuff like that. And which leads me, you say, oh, unions. Well, yeah. The UAW, United Auto Workers President Bob King, and religious leaders say they plan to withdraw hundreds of millions of dollars from J.P. Morgan Chase accounts to protest the bank's refusal to agree to a two-year freeze on foreclosures in Michigan. King, a farm union leader, Valdemar Veliquez, and two clerics held a conference at the Central United Methodist Church in Detroit to announce their campaign against the New York-based bank. Bob King said in a statement, Chase needs to help unemployed homeowners in Michigan. Organizers are also protesting the bank's ties to tobacco company R.J. Reynolds, which they say has refused to negotiate with the Farm Labor Organizing Committee over wages and working conditions at farms of contract growers in North Carolina. So the second thing, the farm workers, that's something from our poorest paid workers. On the other hand, the first one doesn't have anything directly to do with unionized workers. Union workers, who by definition get a higher wage, by definition get a higher wage, aren't the ones that are the most under the gun for foreclosures. But it's Bob King taking what he promised, an increase in social activism at the UAW. And he's now moving to protect all of people that he doesn't represent directly, and that's the value among many things of our labor unions. And full disclosure, I belong to a labor union. All right, some of you have been waiting a long time. My apologies. 313-298-WRIF, which is
313-298-9743.
And we're talking about the health care plan that's going into effect now. Some of you want to talk about that. That's fine. Stan, hi.
Good evening.
You're on the air.
Gentlemen, how's everybody doing tonight?
We're doing good.
Great.
I'm doing good. I'd just like to start out by saying, imagine, quoting John Lennon, that there's no country or no religion to to just imagine.
One of my favorite songs.
We imagine it a lot.
just imagine. I mean, his words, you know, to this day, it's coming true. There's no religion in no country. And people are so concerned about what's happening on this news and the one-eyed monster that they sit down at the dinner table to watch every night that brainwashes them and turns them into ignoramuses with their heads in the sand. And it demoralizes them. And what people have failed to realize is this is exactly what they're trying to accomplish, is demoralization and turn religion against religion. And I want to just bring up on the sideline, I mean, it's not capitalism no more. It's not socialism turning into capitalism. It's not communism. It's globalization.
Yeah,
they've achieved the demoralization of capitalism.
Well, you know, that's been going on for a long time. You got to remember, I mean, when did that start happening? In the 15th century. I mean, what was Columbus and Magellan and all those guys about? They are about globalization.
These people have accomplished their objective to a world government, and they are using the taxpayers as collateral. And what, $13 trillion debt, and people want to put Republicans back in?
Well, you know, Stan, I don't think they care so much about world government. They may not, but I mean, what is key to it is the economic structure that you're right on the money about. I mean, I don't think that the United States is going to cede any of its sovereignty over to any international body, certainly not to the United Nations, which just appears weaker all the time. But I think you hit it on a lot of the other points. All right, thank you for calling. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Dale in Romulus. Dale, hi, you're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
We're good.
I want to talk about the health care.
Sure.
Okay. It's going to blow everything way out of. If people like me don't have any.
Yeah.
It's going to help. How are we going to end up having to pay for this? And I was talking to a friend of mine tonight. They're going to have to raise sales tax on the prescription drugs just to pay for the health care.
Where did you get that idea?
A buddy of mine was telling me that tonight. We were talking about it tonight. And that's,
well, you know, I got to tell you, Dale, just because a buddy of yours...
I'd be curious. I ask for a source on that.
Yeah, just because a buddy of yours tells you that. I mean, listen...
That's what we were saying at the beginning of the show, Peter. No one knows.
Yeah.
It's all very confusing.
It's not clear. It's also, Dale...
Including us.
Not clear. I mean, see, if you aren't... if you don't have a certain level of income, that you will get... what do they call it? Subsidy. I have no idea how that is going to work. And the reason that this whole system is so crazy and not simple is because it still adheres to these profit-swollen medical companies, these health insurance companies. I mean, listen, let me tell you one of the things they do, because I just got into this, what is it, United Healthcare? I think it's just United Healthcare. Yeah, UHC. This multi-billion dollar company. And, of course, it makes money off its premiums and all of that, but they have this thing called health savings account. So we the company and me, we put money into it. And guess what happens when the money is sitting in those accounts? Because it's not just sitting. They invest it. So this health company is not just trying to looking out for me and looking out for Dale and all if you're insured by it, but what it's doing is looking out for its speculative investments. So it's a huge racket. And it's not under control. Obama apparently did not have the capacity even to slightly bring it under control, because you remember he wanted these things called a public option, which would have created a competition. Hello, isn't that capitalism? That's not socialism. So that these healthcare bandits wouldn't be able to rob the population in the manner that they've done. How this is all going to shake out, and I would just, Jolene is correct. I would say careful about the information you get. I don't know, you know, if it turns out to be a disaster, it'll be self-evident. It's not self-evident to me yet that it's at that level. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your comments. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Jeff in New Hudson. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Good. I'm fine.
I guess just one question. First of all, I'm not part of any political party. I have to admit I wasn't really that enamored with the health care plan. I guess in part because, I guess in part when it was presented to the Congress, it seemed like there was like these swings at a baseball. You know, it was like, well, the first plan was like $1 trillion over 10 years. They didn't like that. Then it was like less than that. And then the final one that was passed, they said, Well, it's deficit neutral, or it may even reduce the deficit.
Right.
And, you know, there wasn't a lot of details. I mean, you've heard some horror stories. I think there's a task force that's examined the health care plan, and it comes from one of the conservative think tanks. And I think they had talked about 159 federal agencies will be created to administer this health care plan, which, to me, I don't think it logically sounds like it's going to be able to deliver health care any more quickly.
Well,
if there's going to be 159 more agencies. But I guess I was trying to look at it from the bigger picture.
Yeah.
Like when they talk about, well, premiums will only go up 1 or 2%. And I thought, okay, well, let's, you know, I don't know all the details. I didn't read all, you know, umpteen thousand pages of this bill. But I thought logically, if you're going to add 26 million people to be insured that were not insured, you're going to eliminate lifetime caps. You're going to eliminate any declination of pre-existing conditions.
Right.
And I thought, oh, and you know, I mean, you have to be pretty hard-hearted to think you wouldn't want health care for everybody.
But
I guess then when they turn around and say, but the cost increase will only be 1 or 2%, it just seems to me so astronomically illogical.
Well, yeah, I share that to some extent. I wonder how this is all going to happen. I mean, if suddenly we have 26 million more people, and that's not even everybody that's uninsured at the time, but by 2014, aren't the doctor's offices going to be a little crowded? I mean, have we got ourselves in that much of a jam? I mean, maybe we should just go back to total dog-eat-dog capitalism, where, I mean, we're pretty close to it as it is. And, you know, if you can afford it, cool. If you can't, screw them.
Yeah,
you know?
Too bad.
Too bad. So
I think there's a middle approach.
I
think that there was certainly a less expensive and less sweeping way to add, you know, maybe lower-income people and children, of course, you know, the most vulnerable people in our society. But I guess when I just heard everything it was going to do, and it was going to be this nirvana, and your health premiums will mainly go up 1 or 2%.
Well, I don't know. I never heard anybody saying it was going to be nirvana. In fact, as I said, it seems to be no one's satisfied with it. Certainly the righties aren't. And most, when they get these polls, if they ask me, are you satisfied with the new health care reform? I would say no. It's difficult for me to understand. I don't see why it's got to be so complicated. I don't see, we just got to get these health for-profit health care firms out of it completely. I mean, then that gives you billions and billions of more. I mean, I don't know what you'd have to do. Maybe buy them out or something like that. But, I mean, why should I have great health care and then my neighbor next to me has none? And somehow doesn't seem to be quite fair. All right. Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Here's Bill. Bill is in KPAC. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, I just wanted to talk about the court system, like with Monica Connors and how she escaped, you know, going into jail so quick, you know.
Well, what about it?
It just boggles my mind that, you know, the working class like me, I got into some trouble a while back. And when I got my sentence, there was no wait. There was click of the cuffs and right into the jail.
Well, you know how you spell justice, right? J-U-S-T-I-C-E. They spell it J-U-S-T hyphen U-S. Just us. So, yeah. So, they, you know, they've got, they're closer to power. They're the, she's probably buddies with the judge that sentenced her. I'm surprised that she got any time at all, and she got sent to Camp Cupcake, as they call it.
That's
right?
Isn't that where Martha Stewart was?
Martha Stewart was there, yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know.
She's there now, that's right.
If you got money, you don't have to go right in, but if, you know, you're a working class person and, you know, you deal with a bit of trouble, bye-bye.
You got it.
Yep, that's right.
You got it. That
sad
is the way it goes.
Sad but true.
Thank you, Bill. Yeah, it is sad but true. We ought to
sad
have a department true. Called Sad But True.
Yeah.
Some lines just opened up at 313-298-WRIF. And let's see, Stephanie writes, Kevin from Clarkson was at a fair in Clarkson today, and someone had placed teabagger flyers all over the fair, and fair workers were just throwing them in the garbage. He just wanted to give you the comment.
Thank you.
Yeah, all right.
Thanks for the comment.
I was just about to go to that one, but let's see. Here's Mike in Monroe, the home of Fermi II, and General George Custer. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks, Peter. Been a fan for a while.
Thank you.
I agree completely with this health care reform. I mean, no other profession can sit there and charge you money to consult you, tell you what you already know.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean?
I mean, as a plumber or a mechanic, I can't say, okay, well, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do to fix your car. It's going to cost you $100.
Why not? You're losing me here. What do you mean, Mike?
I mean, it's insane. Why does the healthcare profession get away with it?
Wait a minute. If a plumber comes into my house, I say, how much is it going to charge? How much are you going to charge to fix this? He says, $100. I say, okay, go ahead. You're saying he gets, the doctors get paid just...
We already know what's wrong with us?
Yeah, they talk to you. They don't even touch you or look at you. They just talk to you and they charge you money.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
Well,
okay.
I don't touch me. I don't even know you. But, sometimes without... Well, the other thing is they maybe it's $100 to talk to you, and then it'd be thousands when they do the tests, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, all right. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Thank you for listening for so long. And let's see. Here's Scott in Westland. Scott, you got to do it kind of quickly. You want to talk about bed bugs?
Yes. I have something serious to say about Christine O'Donnell, but I'll get to the boring part first. There's been a lot of stories about bed bugs, on the news lately.
There's a resurgence, apparently.
Yeah, exactly. Well, okay, this is probably what I think is the best practical advice I could give to somebody if they had bed bugs. And the solution is rubbing alcohol. You can go to like a big box store and buy a generic pump sprayer like you would use to water plants or something like that. And in some cases, the pump sprayers actually will screw right onto a 91% bottle of isopropyl alcohol.
Wait, Scott, this is fascinating. But get on to Christine McDonald.
And you got to get in the little crevices on the edge where that little lip I saw this on one of those crazy shows.
What about
bed bugs? It'll kill them on contact.
All right. What about speaking of bed
alcohol,
bugs?
We got it.
The lady from Delaware?
Well, okay. Actually, I guess I'm going to steal a joke from Bill Maher. That basically it's ironic that she was elected. You know, that she's against masturbation because she was elected by whack jobs.
Hey, you know what? I came up with that one all on my own the other day. I didn't even steal it from Bill.
I thought I heard it.
Wow.
Bill Maher has these clips of Christine. Is that her first name?
Christine O'Donnell. And for those who are like, who the hell is Christine O'Donnell? She just won the primary for governor.
From Senate from Delaware.
Senate.
To replace Joe Biden.
Yes.
And,
thank you.
And she, again, she's this teabagger and has said the most outlandish things against masturbation.
She said if her husband masturbated, then what is she even there for?
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julian Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julian will be taking more of your calls right after this.
This is Matt Demmer from Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury. I'm here to tell you that now it's more important than ever to buy an American-made vehicle. We at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury are still in the business of leasing and want to help you. Whether you're looking for the hot new Lincoln MKS, the sleek Lincoln MKZ, or the hottest crossover vehicle, the Lincoln MKX, Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury in Dearborn is your one-stop shop. At our dealership, we believe in honesty, reliability, and support for our customers just like you. We encourage you to check out our virtual showroom on our website, Demmer.com. You can check out our vehicle inventory, and you can bet that if we don't have the vehicle you're in the market for, we'll do our very best to get it for you. While you're online, we invite you to get a no-obligation internet price quote. Whether you come into our newly renovated dealership or visit us online, we at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury invite you to experience the Demmer difference today. We're located on Michigan Avenue just east of Oakwood in Dearborn. Give us a call today, 313-274-8800. That's 313-274-8800. Or check us out on the web at Demmer.com.
There's free, and then there's free. And for a limited time at Verizon, free has taken on a whole new meaning. Like free devices that amp your style and get it done on America's largest and most reliable 3G network. And it's all red hot and free through September 30th. Take the LG Cosmos, a serious texting fiend, free. Or the feature-rich Chocolate Touch, free. Or the Master of the Universe BlackBerry Curve 2. That's right, free. Each after up to $100 mail-in rebate debit card. These aren't your run-of-the-mill, okay, sure, why not, free. These are check out my new toy and don't need fingerprints free. But hurry, these red-hot and free deals end September 30th. Visit any Verizon store today, verizonwireless.com, or call 1-800-256-4646. Rule the air. Verizon. All phones require new 2-year activation. BlackBerry requires $29.99 data package. Trunk and Touch requires $9.99 data package. Early termination and other fees apply. Coverage details at verizonwireless.com.
Do you owe back taxes to the IRS that you can't afford to pay? Or are you stuck in a tax payment plan that's getting you nowhere? The IRS is now taking very aggressive actions, such as bank levies and wage garnishments. If you owe the IRS at least $15,000, call American Tax Relief. They've helped thousands of people like you eliminate up to 85% of their delinquent taxes. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, American Tax Relief can settle your tax debts for less than you owe, remove penalties and interest, and protect you from bank levies and garnishments. As a hardworking American, you do have rights. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation and see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, you can save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Call right now. 1-800-493-8159. That's 1-800-493-8159.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour. In 1 hour, let me see, oh yeah, in about 50 seconds, going to have a couple of interesting guests that I interviewed earlier in the week. The first one, what should we do? Andre Codrescu, the NPR commentator and author. Now, this is not going to sound interesting because most
you
people...
You say this every week, Peter.
I know.
selling yourself.
He's written a book called The Poetry Lesson.
Okay.
Yeah, the people are going, oh, man, wow, he's really... I mean, most, you know, all right, it's poetry. Lock the doors. Nobody gets out. He says that poetry is much more interesting and way more subversive than you think, so...
There we go. We like subversive.
And Andre has that Transylvanian accent because he came from Romania.
Ah, cool, right, cool. Yeah.
Also, Jeff Foe, founder of the Economic Policy Institute, talking about why there aren't enough jobs and what has to be done to get them. He's going to be appearing in Detroit. And you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. And there is a calendar there. And the calendar says if this slow machine ever opens.
I think you should do that interview first.
What do you mean?
That's my vote for the jobs interview.
Okay. All right. I'll do that.
Coming up at 1 a.m. Eastern time. And by the way, while you're looking that up, Peter,
yeah.
I just want to say that we do have open lines. So if you want to call, if you've always wanted to call, if you think you might want to call, just give a call. 313-298-WRIF.
Or
313-298-9743.
Right.
Peter directs me from over there, yes.
Jeff Foe, his name is on here, from the Economic Policy Institute. He's a free forum, the jobs crisis. How did it happen? How long will it last? And what can we do to solve it? Oh, man, that's really exciting. Well, it's not supposed to be exciting, folks. It's about our lives.
It's called information.
It's Tuesday, September 28th at 7 p.m. at the McGregor Conference Center at Wayne State University. And it's free. So you can check it out again. You go to my calendar page. And you can find it all out.
Earlier, Peter, I
was talking about it. Didn't seem to make sense that if there is a God as defined by Christians and Jews and Muslims, that he would have picked some small little tribe in a desert among these. Let me see. We said there was 100 million galaxies, and the Milky Way that we're in has 50 billion stars. And how many planets are revolving around each one of those stars? And I was trying to figure out what was 50 billion times 100 million.
And the keywords that you just said were that we're in, the Milky Way that we're in, right?
Yeah, right.
Okay, so Jerry wrote in and he said it's 20 zeros. So 12, and then 5, and then 20 zeros.
Wow.
Can you do it? Well, can you think it?
Can anyone say it?
I can't say it.
Because he doesn't say it like they have.
What is it, Jerry?
Yeah.
What is it?
So what are the chances? Well, let's give it two ways. If it's just a matter of random chance.
Sextillion.
Sextillion?
S-E-X.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, don't go crazy on it. So it's how many sextillion?
12. I don't know how you say it.
Yeah. Well, anyway, sextillion planets or stars or what are stars? And then there's that many more planets revolving around each of these. And any one of them could have life form. So that there's a couple of ways you could look at it. One is that it's absolutely preposterous that to think that there would be a God that would center all of his activities on one little group here on
when
one little planet.
Yeah,
when you have all the possibilities.
Out there.
Or the other thing is you could say God works in mysterious ways. And if he does, and he is actually there, or she is there, or however you want to define it, it is there, why did he or she create all the rest of it? Why bother?
You know, Peter,
you could have done this in 3 days.
This is a new one because usually you use the wheelchair reference.
What's that?
Is if there were really a God?
Oh.
Why are there people in wheelchairs?
No, why
can't they be cured?
Why can't why if God can do miracles and heal people?
Yeah. Why
can't he restore amputees?
Oh. Here. That's a good point.
Yeah. Okay. All right. And again, if I'm messing with your beliefs, I'm sorry, but if I am, you probably just think I'm an ignorant fool. But so
and you'll probably tell them about it.
Yeah. Now, here's something really important because I've told that little Zen story before. Yeah, I did, about the young monk who comes to the monastery doors, knocks, slamming on it in the middle of the night, and the Zen monk says, what are you waking us in the middle of the night? He's all disheveled, and he hasn't slept in days. And he says, Master, I told this the other day. Well, I must know the meaning of life.
Yeah, what was it?
And the master slams him in the head with his stave and says, there, that'll give you something serious to think about.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I mean, hello. Let's what's more important, belief in God or why there aren't enough jobs, all right? Or, as Michael writes in the call talk, yes@yahoo.com, the FBI has been recently raiding the homes of peace activists while claiming that they have evidence of terrorist activities. My response to this is that Big Brother is 10 miles away and carrying telescreens. We should band together before he arrives and activism gives way to bland, oppressive... I don't know what... I can't even pronounce it. I think he just kind of made up the word. But anyway, here's what's happening. Where did that all go? Do you have that?
Is this in Minneapolis and Chicago?
Yeah.
FBI agents, it was just 2 days ago, they executed search warrants Friday in Minneapolis and Chicago in connection to an investigation of support of terror organizations, which it was not. They searched the homes of people who have helped organize demonstrations against the war in Iraq and protests held 2 years ago at the Republican National Convention in St. Paul. I remember that.
Now, this is really frightening. Well, no, there
it
is
really
something
is
called the RNC 8, the Republican National Committee 8 Convention. I'm sorry, the Republican National Convention 8 in 2008, who were arrested preemptorily. I mean, before anything got happened and charged with all these crimes of terrorism and all that. And they've, over the last couple of years, they've dropped charges against them. They've... let one guy plead out to a misdemeanor. And this is just state oppression. And I got to tell you, I mean, I'm always urging you on to activism. And I would say that 99.9% of people that are involved in resistance and protest activities, whether you're on the left or the right, nothing ever happens.
Peaceful.
Yeah, peaceful.
Yeah.
But then sometimes people are victimized by the government.
Yes.
And this is obviously a case of it. Well, you, and I'm sorry now, who was, what was the person's name I was just reading from? Do you remember? Michael it was. Michael.
Oh.
Yeah. There is going to be a demonstration against that, an emergency demonstration to support anti-war and international solidarity activists and stop FBI raids and harassment. It's going to be Tuesday, September 28th, 4:30 p.m. at the McNamara Federal Building in downtown Detroit. That's Michigan at Cass Avenue. Now, Michael, you just said that we should band together before he arrives. That's Big Brother. Well, indeed we should. And indeed you should. So I don't know where you didn't sign where you were from, but this is the kind of thing you should go down to and take part of. And you right-wingers, you teabaggers that are always talking about an oppressive government, here is a case of that. Let's see your butt down there, right? Or is it you just want to take health care away from people? All right, let's go back to our phones. Here is Sam. Sam is in Detroit. Sam, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. Hey, Jalene.
Hello.
I want to talk about Rob Wolchek and how he bamboozled the whole southeastern Michigan area with it, trying to say his story was about guys drinking on a job, when all it was a hit job on the UAW and Barack Obama. He started that story off with 3 minutes of the president and the union before he even got to the guys drinking.
Wow.
Wait, let's set this up a little. What happened is Fox 2... in Detroit, which is a all the people on there, by the way, Sam, are union members of my union, which, you know, they're probably going to do the story they were assigned to regardless. And what they did is they took all these films of UAW guys hanging out and drinking and I get what? And smoking weed?
Yep.
Yeah. So where did set this up a little? I mean, how did they bring Obama and the unions in general into it?
All it was a hit job on the bailout, the UAW and Barack Obama. They were supposedly watching Chrysler workers on their lunch break drinking and smoking weed, which goes on in every industry all over the country.
That's right.
Sure.
People, there's a small percentage of people that do that.
Yeah.
It's been going on in the UAW. I mean, in the plant since Henry Ford.
Yeah, this guy in one of my classes told the class the other day in relation to the story that he used to work on the line. He said they'd mix their drink right there on the line.
But before they even got to the guys drinking and smoking weed, they did 4 minutes on the bailout.
On the bailout, okay. Yeah. So I see. So what they were setting up, they bailed out the auto company, and here are these guys drinking on their lunch hour. Well, I got to tell you, when my buddies back in the day, when they worked out at the Dodge Truck in Warren, they had set up what they called the groove room. They took this little storage room, and then they took all these floor mats and put them up on the wall and on the ceiling, and they would go in the plant. And, in fact, I lived with some of these guys, and they would be rolling these J's to take
right
to the
there,
plant.
Right?
Yeah. And I said to him one time, I don't know how you can work when you're stoned. He looked at me and said,
I can't work not stoned.
Yeah.
You know, my next-door neighbor actually is an iron worker.
Yeah.
And he went out to do some work at U.S. Steel, and they are strict enforcement out there on the drugs and alcohol. And he got profiled for having long hair, and it was not good.
I mean, he took a test?
He had to take a drug test.
Yeah.
And he's never allowed back on the property.
Well,
again.
This was a Chrysler. So this is back in the day, and this is a Chrysler plant, and where these guys are in the groove room smoking, and the foreman knew about it. They said, "Just get the production out. You meet the production."
We'll leave you alone.
And they couldn't care. Well, Bob King, in fact, commented on this, Sam, as you may have seen, and said the UAW and Chrysler have a joint program for alcohol and drug abuse, and one of the things that we say is that I don't know who the we is, maybe Jalene join me, is that a company has the right to have a drug-free workplace, but what we do on our off hours is absolutely nobody's business but our own. Hey,
right, Rob Wolchek, I guarantee you in a couple of years, he just earned himself a job on the Fox Cable Channel. He's going to get a heck of a promotion.
Well, maybe he will. All right, Sam, thanks for bringing that up. Anybody else see that and have that view of it, that it was a hit piece? And
well, everyone's talking about it.
Probably some of you. Yeah, isn't that interesting? I mean, you know, that. So what does that tell you? So you had, what's the suggestion there? That is all the work, is that as a representative sample, or is it just a small group, or what have you? I don't know about you, but when I've had 9-to-5 jobs, which isn't very frequent.
Ah, Peter.
I did once in a while. You know, you go out to lunch, you have a beer, you know? Right.
Okay. The old days. I don't know. I don't.
Open lines for you. Yeah, so any of you old factory rats or current ones, what's the scene there, and does it affect anything? It's not a good idea to be... Well, I don't know. I guess these guys worked on a line, and they were smoking...
I just worried about the danger aspect of alcohol. Pot, I could care less.
Well, it's not... don't you think you could get into a kind of like...
Zone?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do think you could.
But these friends of mine, they made it through, and I'll bet you a lot of other people probably did as well. Here's Nate in Redford. Nate, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
We're good.
How you doing, Jolene?
Hi, good. Thank you.
So my question is, or what I want your opinion on, is the Michigan film tax incentive. I'm not in the film industry, but what I do is kind of related to it. And I see an awful lot of people getting put to work by it. But the Lansing, I hear complaining that it's just too much. It's too big. Not that I want to tell somebody else who to vote for governor necessarily, but who I'm looking at as what would be my favorite is very much against the film incentive and wants to completely dismantle it. And my opinion is more along the lines of, well, rework it, maybe even reduce it slightly, but to eliminate it, you know, give it a couple of years to get Hollywood more entrenched here, get them more comfortable here and realize how good it can be before we pull the rug out from underneath this program.
Yeah, I don't know what to say. I should have actually looked into that more. I know there's an attorney friend of mine that's taken out full-page ads in Detroit's Metro Times denouncing it, saying that it's a dead loss for the state of Michigan. And I didn't read this article about it too carefully, but there was a commission that said, in fact, it's working out to be a deficit for the state. I know that my union, certainly the Screen Actors Guild, the stagehands, all these people they'll probably kill me for even suggesting something like that. But I have to say, I don't know about it entirely, and I'm, go ahead.
The thing is everybody talks about how much work that they're giving or not giving to, or bringing or not bringing people in from out of state to do some of this work. But nobody ever mentions the fact that all of these people that are coming in from out of state are staying in hotels.
Right.
They're
right.
eating at restaurants. They're going to hardware stores. They're buying clothes. So the impact is so much greater than just the directly related entertainment dollar.
Yeah, I mean, I hope you're absolutely right, Nate, because I've just seen so many films being made. I was just down at the Cass Cafe near Wayne State University, and we walked by Old Main on Warren and Cass, and there was Sigourney Weaver. They were doing this film called Vamps, and they were using the Hillbury Theater across the street. It was great fun. You know, there was a couple hundred people all watching, and man, it takes forever to shoot even the smallest little scene. But so it's kind of sharp that it's all happening. The state of Michigan cannot afford, of course, things that are going to drain its revenue all the more. And I don't know. I wasn't arguing against you or the program, because I have to say, and I probably am remiss in not doing so, I don't know enough about it. Even in terms of the study they did, I mean, did they take into account all the sort of the variables that you're talking about? So I don't know. I mean, how are you, if you want to say, connected to the film industry?
I work for a company that does lighting.
Okay.
We do more lighting for live events, for entertainment, for corporate events. It's not the same equipment. But a lot of the equipment crosses lines, you know. You couldn't go into my warehouse and pull out of enough equipment to go out and shoot a movie. But they can borrow an awful lot of my cable, and they can borrow an awful lot of my trussing. And
well, I think it's, as you said, it's been good for the state in terms of image and how we feel.
Absolutely.
And it's nice to watch, like,
it's
Hunger,
cool.
Or even, I mean, Detroit 187.
Did you watch it?
God, I thought that was terrible.
It. At first I thought.
Hey, John, Nate, thank you so
Thanks
much.
For the
Let's
call.
See, maybe some more people will comment on that. I hope so. What?
Yeah, at first I thought, I don't think I'm going to like this, but I got a little sucked in. I like the lead character, and I liked when they mentioned Ferndale, and you know, that was
what's
kind
the lead
of fun.
Character's name?
Michael Imperioli.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't like him at all.
You don't? Oh, I don't know. For some reason, as Chris on The Sopranos, I liked the guy, even though he was like horrible to women.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I didn't like that part, believe me. The man wrote in, Peter. The man. Okay? That's his name on the email.
Yeah.
I said, about religion, we've been giving it a pretty good workover, right? So what kills me the most is that his good buddy is a heavy Christian, has four kids, and his third child has Down syndrome. And I keep asking him, if your God is true, why would he give your child Down syndrome? Wow.
Well, heavy. You know...
heavy, man.
Yeah.
Just like Peter.
But that doesn't, you know, that doesn't work for all Christians, because... I mean, other than the obvious God works in mysterious ways answer, some people just think, well, God created the world, and he had a son that came to redeem us for our original sin, and the rest was just nature and,
Yeah, I don't know.
Except if God is omniscient, sees everything, he knew, he knew Eve was going to blow it.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, well, you mean eat, bite the apple?
Yeah, right. And knew everything was going to happen. He said, well, it's free will. It's not free will. It was all known in advance.
Yeah,
where's
like,
the free will?
What
there?
Up, God? And Joe from John from Madison Heights, on the same note, says, I'm beginning to think gods do exist, but they have God elections up in heaven. The current president, God, has been inept for centuries, that they have long terms up there. They have long terms up there. And we need to pray for a heavenly recall.
There you go. All right, let me get back to the phones, 313-298-WRIF. I want to get some of these calls in about smoking and drinking on the job in the plants, but there's also some people that want to talk about the film business, so stay on the line. We'll get
hey,
you
Peter,
all.
Hey, Peter, can you hand me that ashtray?
What are you doing?
I'm having a cocktail.
No, you're eating.
I know.
What are you going to do? How are you
going to have a little
Don't
bite.
Talk with your mouth full. All right, here is Ryan in Livonia. Hey, Ryan, you're on the air with Peter and Jalene. Welcome.
Hello, how are you guys doing?
We're good. We're good.
Awesome. Cool. I just heard your show tonight for the first time. I really enjoy it.
Oh, thanks.
Cool. Welcome.
I mean, I don't know, man. I'll be honest with you guys. Like, I got this real bad ADHD thing going on, you know? A lot of kids say they have it, but it's kind of hard to deal with at work because you get so used to routine, you know? Like, a new job's cool at first, but you get so used to routine and it, like, dulls down and everything just starts to suck a little bit, but... Let me catch my breath.
Well, are you medicated?
Well, no. I actually took Adderall for a real long time, and I just got off that stuff because it messes with you.
I think it's good you're off of it. And, you know, sometimes ADHD, like, Peter and I are both a little ADD. We always say it's ADD radio. It helps in certain occupations. We can multitask. We can talk about all these different subjects, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like lately I feel like I have to, like, be able to voice my opinion because all the things I want to do are just very... routine-based, but, I mean, that's up to me to figure out. I got to make the first step with that. But, like, the Adderall, I mean, you shouldn't really do anything that makes you calm down that hard and makes you think like that. It just, if you're thinking about taking Adderall, I don't really suggest it. It's a good buzz, but, you know.
People crush it and snort it for recreation.
Really?
Yeah.
I'll tell you, I don't know how much reading you do, Ryan, but one of our old colleagues and friend, Tom Hartman, you can spell it any way, he spells it T-H-O-M-H-A-R-T-M-A-N-N. He's written a couple of books about
ADD
and ADHD.
Yeah. Look those up because I think you could be really...
And one thing that's, fortunate or unfortunate, I guess you'd say it's unfortunate, is that most people don't have a whole range of choices when it comes to jobs. Like if I'm a little claustrophobic and I'm real ADD, I'm in the right biz. I don't have to stay in here real long. And when I'm playing, like, songs, you know, I can put on a song and go take a walk around.
Mm-hmm.
Like, most of us got to stay at their desk, stay at their machine.
Yeah, that's tough.
Yeah.
That is really tough.
But, Tom Hartman, writes, and he says in some cases that medication, will really save jobs.
Does
help? Not help. He says sometimes it's the only alternative. All right, Ryan, thank you very much. Let's get an old factory rat on the air. It's Earl from Algonac. Hey, Earl, you're on the air.
How you doing? Nice to see you. Or talk to you.
Yeah, same here.
I'm a GM worker, or used to be. I'm retired now.
Okay. That makes you an old factory rat.
It makes me an old fetcher.
Right.
I was a union steward or committee man for some years, and a health and safety rep.
Okay.
For some years. And a line worker and a tool maker. So I've done just about everything from wash to floors to chase stock to put cars together to, you know, I've done it.
All over the place.
So this is nothing. This is nothing new. What the Fox 2 cut.
Well, you know, yeah, no, it's not. You know, and back in the day, probably when I first started at GM, it was really a big deal. I mean, you know, it was a lot more prevalent than it is now. If they suspect that you're drinking on the job or you're high on the job, they take you to medical. And you do a blood test, and if you don't pass the blood test, then you're put on in a program,
mm-hmm.
and they can make you, what they call a drop. They can make you drop anytime they want. Okay, and if you have drugs or alcohol in your system, they fire you, or they put you in a rehab program. You know,
yeah,
it's not the way this guy makes it sound like. You know, it's not. You know, I have to tell you, a job working in that plant will drive you to drink.
That's what this guy in my class said. He said he went crazy. He went nuts. He almost snapped.
These people work like dogs, and management treats them like dogs. Oh, they really do. I mean, management, it's the animosity there is just, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. I had 30 years there, and I couldn't, the minute I got my 30 years and I retired,
yeah.
I couldn't stand it anymore.
You're in a better place now, huh?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, Algonac is sure a nice place to be.
Yeah.
I want to get back to the reporter. This guy did a piece a few days ago on break-ins in break-ins mm-hmm. outside a courthouse.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Now, is it me? I mean, I personally think it's morally wrong to photograph or take a video of someone breaking into a car and allow them to do it.
Yeah,
there's something wrong with that.
Unless you're calling 911 at the same time.
Yeah. He didn't call anyone, and then he had the nerve to go interview the lady that they broke in her car, took their purses, took whatever they could find in the trunk. Their purses were in there, apparently. At least that's what it looked like they were carrying when they got out of the car.
Yeah.
And he let them do it. He didn't call the police. He didn't do anything.
This guy's ridiculous.
If he would have came up to me after they broke into my car and said that he saw him do it and he videotaped him and didn't do anything, I'd have broke his face.
Well, I'll tell you. I mean, when you watch the local news, it sometimes is interesting, but it's really not news. I mean, it's nothing that...
It's a lot of hype, and yeah, I used to be a news reporter. I know exactly, and that's called the tease, the art of the tease, where they want to hook you, and when I was a news reporter, and I will admit this, when I got someone to cry, I was like, oh, I'd get in the car, and I'd be like, oh, man, we got the tears. This is great. Okay, so that's how we think, or they think. And on that note, Brian and Royal Oak said, just because Channel 2 is local, it's still Fox-affiliated. Their tentacles reach far and wide.
Hey, Earl, thank you very much. Appreciate your comments on that. I got to tell you, it's worthless almost watching all of that because it is. It's just fires. It's crime. It's mm-hmm. crap that we've been talking about. It'd be a good time just to read something. And if you don't want to read, you know, I don't know why. It took me so long to discover this, and I can't remember... The name, well, for one thing, I just got this mega sound system for my television. You know, I went for this guy that never watched television.
You went from a guy who had like a 30-year-old television with
23-inch.
No cable.
Yeah, right. And now I just got this huge, what do they call it, theater or something like that.
Surround sound?
No, yeah, but it's
home theater. Whatever.
Home theater, yeah. So I found this station that plays concerts. It's, I don't know, 209 on Comcast?
Yeah, yeah.
Palladia, maybe? Is that a...
Yes.
Yeah, Palladia. And wow, I'm going, wow, man. You know, so do that. I mean, forget about this local news. You know?
Yeah. Fill your brain with art and music and good things.
There you go.
Information, good information.
Here's John in Detroit. Maybe some more on the film business. Hey, John, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to comment on the pros and cons of the film business here in Michigan.
Sure.
I think it's really great here. I work within the industry, and I think it's a long term. It's a great thing, but there needs to be some changes in the incentive package, because what's happening is we're getting more and more people from other states: Louisiana, New York, Chicago, California, even as far as south as Miami. They're coming here to work, and they're getting a 30% tax credit. So what we're doing is we're buying jobs from other states.
Now, you know what? One of the things that's happening that I heard about is that film companies will send people into Detroit, buy like three houses for, say, $40,000. Three houses, $40,000, and then they get a higher tax break, right? Because they're Detroiters. They have a Detroit address.
That's right.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, everybody else gets, as long as you are a resident here of the state, you get a 40% tax credit on those employees. And anyone who is above the line, like a producer, a director, people who need to come from Hollywood, which, of course, have to be here for the movie. But it's becoming a problem because, you know, you have 100 to 120 people on a film crew on the average, and you're seeing 80 people here from out of state. So I think our legislature is waking up. And, you know, I'd hate to see them get rid of it because it really is benefiting our communities somewhat. And long term, it could really be a new industry here, employing people.
Absolutely.
But if you look at the what we spent, which is around $300 million in tax credits last year, and let's just say we're employing at maximum 2,000 people, which I think is very high, that would be that we are subsidizing jobs for $150,000 per job.
Hey, Toya, but tell us exactly what happens. A company comes to Michigan, and they shoot a film here, and their costs are, say, $20 million.
Okay.
Do they get a? They don't get a check for $20 million. They
No.
get a check for a 30% of that.
Essentially, all their expenditures. Let's say I'll give you like Gran Torino, for instance. That
right.
was a Clint Eastwood movie. That was $20 million picture, and they spent $20 million here in expenditure on Michigan things. Everything they bought, all the labor they hired here. They get a check for 40% back.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
30 to 40%.
That's amazing.
So let's just say on, you know, $20 million, they're going to get, say, $6 to $8 million back at the end of the movie. So they have to come into the film office in the state, and the Treasury Department makes them fill out all the paperwork. They're approved for the tax credit, and then at the end of the movie, they have to be audited to see how much money they spent, and then that is. Whatever expenditures were here, they are returned to with a check and a tax credit. So that's essentially how it works.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just a problem that all these people who are out of work in Hollywood and other states, you know, throughout the country are now coming here. And I think we've got to put a squash on that, but that's very hard to do. People have a right to come here and work like anyone else who would move to another state for another job, like manufacturing. But how do we control this so it makes it beneficial for the state, but, you know, beneficial to the taxpayers here who don't want to see us, you know, wasting our tax dollars employing other people?
Well, certainly when we're in the mess we are. Well, listen, thank you very much.
Very interesting.
When we come back, I actually have the Free Press story on that kind of presents the people directly involved at the top level of it all. On both sides of it, whether that can allow us to make a decision which way it's going, but appreciate your take on it. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Nightfall with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Feels like time's running out. Maxed out on your credit cards, collection calls are coming every day, and you're two payments behind on your mortgage. You need help. We're Credit Card Relief, and we've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. Call Credit Card Relief right now. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Call 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. Call 866-290-8282. That's 866-290-8282. Did you know the tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health. but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe-clogging line scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Lime scale deposits block the heating element, and that could be costing you an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove lime scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy with HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents lime scale buildup in your entire plumbing system. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances with HydraCare. Try it risk-free. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com. Or call now, 888-883-8187. That's 888-883-8187.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan.
Well, let's see our mass murder for the week. A woman believed to have shot four members of her family. Killing three before taking her own life in West Seattle. All right, let's go back to our phone, 313-298-WRIF. We are talking about, is this film industry a giveaway to out-of-state companies, or is it actually helping the economy? Just before we do that, though, this is the kind of thing that I can't imagine that anybody in this country would approve of, so why is it happening? There was a shipment of laptop computers that went to Iraq's main seaport this February. It was a small but important part of the American military's missions here to win hearts and minds, or buy them off, I guess you'd say,
yeah,
with our tax dollars. And guess what? They all went missing. They were supposed to be bought for school children in Babel, modern-day Babylon, a gift of the American taxpayers. Anybody here okay with that? 8,080 of them worth $1.8 million.
Yikes.
$1.8 million were bought for school children in Babel, Iraq.
So where are they?
I wonder if there's any other cities that could have used that those computers. Anybody think of any?
Oh, wait, it starts with a D.
Yeah, the D.
Yeah.
Whew. Wow. Well, yeah, but that's what's happening because we're trying to buy the hearts and minds, and we did. They think we're big suckers. Well, here's what's happening with the film program. And I wanted to just, here, this is my way of keeping people on the air. Steve from Dearborn and Floyd from Clinton Township. We'll get to you in just 1 minute, but hold on.
And just about 20 minutes left of the show. So if you have something you want to say, 313-298-WRIF.
Yeah. Right. So if I can get these little things out of the authors of a controversial study indicating that Michigan subsidies for in-state TV and film production are a net loser for taxpayers defended the findings before a state Senate committee. They said the subsidies are so generous, covering up to 42% of costs incurred on production in Michigan. There is virtually no way they can generate enough economic activity to make the state budget whole. They found that for each dollar paid out in incentives generated about 11 cents in additional tax revenue. So a dead loss, according to this study. But let's see, who is Olson? Gary Olson, Senate Fiscal Agency Director, said that it unquestionably created private sector economic activity and jobs would not have occurred without him. Carrie Jones, director of the Michigan Film Office, criticized the fiscal agency report for what she said was a failure to account for the ancillary benefits. And
that's right.
That's one of our callers said.
And Chef Dave wrote in from Southfield and said, "Hi, Peter. I'm a chef in the hotel industry. The amount of rooms we keep full and mouths we feed from the film industry keeps everyone hourly working." Mm-hmm. Thanks again.
Including positive publicity for Michigan, inspiration for young people, and entrepreneurs the state needs for long-term prosperity. So those are what they call intangible. Jones said more permanent jobs and stable tax revenue will result over the long term as Michigan workers become more skilled in jobs required for filmmaking, and some of the studio projects planned for the state are fully online. All right, still some open lines, 313-298-WRIF. Here is Floyd in Clinton Township. Floyd, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good.
Hey, I just want to mention, first of all, before I get to the point that I want to make, seeing Sean Penn on at the Tigers game today. So, you know,
really?
Yeah, he was sitting in there in the stands.
Where's Sean Penn fans?
Well, you know, he must be in here doing a film.
Yeah, must be.
I hope he's listening to this show.
I seen where they were drinking and smoking on the job, you know. The only thing that really bothers me about that is I don't mind about getting a buzz, you know what I mean, but there's a time and place for that. I mean, I'm driving a Chevrolet, and it's a doggone lemon.
What year?
It's an 02. Yeah. I've had nothing but trouble with the transmissions and, you know, major things and leaks in the antifreeze system. I had to have a new head gasket put on. And I mean, they go back to work and they're high, and they don't care how they put these cars together.
Well, we got to get some more. I mean, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I don't know that is the reason for poor quality. I mean, there was a little problem with Toyotas. Wasn't there a little something about the accelerator?
Thing.
Yeah, but I mean, that was actually in the design. It wasn't worker-related. But again, Floyd, we don't know whether this represents, you know, like one point, 0.1% of the workforce, or the suggestion is, of course, is that it's widespread.
It's rampant, right?
Yeah. So we don't know, right?
Right, but I used to work at a GM years ago doing millwright out in Flint, and I go in the bathroom there, and they're all in there drinking, sleeping, and as soon as the foreman come in, they all scatter and they run back to their jobs.
Wow. Well, I talked to some guys that put together Fermi 2, and they said they did not want to be within, they were wrong, of course, they said they didn't want to be within four states of it when they fired it up, and they used to bring in cases of beer, and they were millwrights, too. They used to bring in cases of beer, cocaine, marijuana. I mean, they would work 7/12s. In other words, 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. They were just ripped to the max. I mean, one of the things that happened in cases like that is that they were just way overworked and were trying to compensate and stay awake. So, I mean, is it management or is it the individual worker?
I don't know if it's this or overworked or whatever, but I mean, if they keep, you know, doing that, I mean, and they go back to work and all buzzed up, I mean, how much of a quality can you put into your job? I mean, you're all goofing around and laughing and.
Well, but they have quality control. You know what? And I don't know the answer to this. I mean, I've had a couple of Ford products, one from, 04, a Taurus and a Fusion from, 2009, and man, they're just working perfect. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know whether if people mess up, if quality control is supposed to make it happen. Also, I mean, isn't there like 100,000-mile warranties and all that? All right, let's see if we can get. We're towards the end of things, but we can take some calls at 313-298-WRIF. Thank you, Floyd. I appreciate your call. And so, guys, gals, if you're working there, what's the deal? I mean, is the individual worker? I mean, a lot of people want to scapegoat union members or the individual workers for what's gone south with the auto companies. What's your thoughts? Here's Steve in Dearborn. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good.
I love his show, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
I've listened to it for years. I've been a union member for quite a few years now. Not necessarily the UAW, but right now I'm a union member. I'll tell you what. I don't disagree with what happened. I think Rob Rolchek did his job. Those guys were wrong. They were dead wrong. Now whether the person that called it in, the supervisors or whoever, like at the plant, I mean, I don't know. But union members aren't all like that. We're hardworking. We do what we have to do, and we'll go above and beyond. There's a lot of times I've worked off the clock, just to get things done. So, you know what? I don't know. I just feel that.
Well, you know,
union members have become like the scapegoat for what's gone wrong in this with the auto industry, with the economic situation in general, rather than putting it right where it belongs. I mean, the unions, the auto workers, the individual auto worker, they don't control anything. It's who controls everything and who makes decisions about the design of cars and what have you. That's management. Yeah, and it's the guys in the $1,500 suits that have sunk this economy, not the individual union worker. All right, Steve, thank you very much. AB, you know, we got some time left, but I just wanted to make sure that I reminded folks about a lot of the stuff that's going on. And this Saturday, there's going to be a very important march, Putting America Back to Work, Pulling America Back Together. It's going to be happening in Washington, D.C., and there are scholarships available if you'd like to take a bus to this march. Ed Schultz, talk show host and an MSNBC commentator, is really banging the gong for that, trying to get as many people there as possible.
On and on, yeah.
And you can go to One Nation Working Together, or I guess it's action.onenationworkingtogether.org. And it gives you all the information there if you want to drive there or something. If you've never been to one of these, and it's an astounding experience to be part of some enormous march. Once you get beyond 5,000, it's kind of hard to even get a feel. But if you're there with 100,000 or 200,000 people, it's quite incredible. And plus, this is for something that's really important. It is talking about getting America back to work and back together. I mean, something that these teabaggers are just not interested in all. They're just their whack job. I don't want to get negative. This is positive. This is, I get negative. But these folks are 100% positive. And also, on Tuesday, just go to my website. You'll see the other thing. There's an emergency demonstration to stop FBI raids and harassment of anti-war activists that I don't even know what the FBI is up to. I mean, if George Bush's FBI would have been doing this, there would have been tens of thousands of people out in the street. Why in the world Barack Obama is allowing this to happen is, beyond me.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, let's see here. Let me, did you look at the, this is interesting. You already read that one. I was looking at a email.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you already read that one.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go back to our phones here. Here is Dave. Dave is in Lincoln Park. Go ahead, Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing, Z?
Good.
All right, yeah, long-time listener. I was just a few things to say. I just want to say when it comes to the how big the universe is and everything, they say it's actually like 17 billion years old, which is they go that by the light years.
What is?
Universe.
Oh, the universe.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, minimum.
And it took like, humans like 20, 30,000 years to evolve?
Yeah, right. We've been around just a little bit.
Yeah, the odds, the odds of like such a vast space. You know, obviously there has to be some type of life out there to go by. And the fact that humans consider themselves so egotistical when it comes to, like, we're the greatest things of mankind or the greatest things of God's creation, then doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah, there's problems there rather than seeing us as an integral part of this web of nature. We see us as special privileged beings on the planet, and if we do, we sure screwed things up. I mean, I was just looking at something about here, how the extreme heat bleaches coral, and you go, oh, what is that? But let me continue.
Well, it messes up the entire ecosystem.
Yes. Thank you, Dave. Here, this year's extreme heat is putting the world's coral reefs under such severe stress that scientists fear widespread die-offs endanger not only the richest ecosystems in the ocean, but also fisheries that feed millions of people. Drastic die-offs of coral were seen for the first time in 1983. And scientists say the trouble with reefs is linked to climate change.
Yeah.
All these whack job righties saying there's no such thing as climate change. It's just liberals trying to make us believe there's climate change.
For real.
They're so weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, they are. Here's Andrew in Flat Rock. Andrew, hi, you're on the air.
How you doing, Pete?
We're good.
Not a very long-time listener, but definitely a second-time caller.
Welcome.
Oh, welcome back.
Thank you.
Can you turn your radio all the way off, though, Andrew?
Sorry, sir?
Turn your radio all the way off, please.
I'm working on it. I apologize.
That's okay. You're second-time calling. You can make that mistake.
With all the talk about the movie industry being in Michigan at the moment, I'm more concerned about why is the state so concerned about having the movie industry in the state as opposed to bringing back the manufacturing, all the manufacturing.
Right, I hear you. But I don't know why either
your
you or somebody.
Your radio's still up.
Yeah, yeah. What's up with that, man? Why is your radio still up? Is somebody else listening?
No, actually, I just turned it down. Yeah, I apologize.
We can hear you loud and clear.
All right. I will answer your question off the air.
Point well taken. Yeah.
Well, I don't think there's a lot of chance that we're going to get industry back to Michigan in the manner that it
been?
Was. Once sort of the toothpaste is out of the tube, I said before that 50 years ago, if the UAW would have said, hey, General Motors, hey, Ford, you're not moving any plants, any of the supplier plants to Alabama or Georgia or states like that where they were starting to move. They figure, wait a minute, man. If we don't have to pay union wages, if we can go to the South where there aren't any unions and pay people crappy wages there, we'll make more money. Because if it's, it's all about how wealth is distributed. If the unions can raise the price of labor, that's less for us and more for them, and we want as much as we can get. I mean, as it is, we've had to put up with a minimum wage, and then we had to put up with unionization, and we couldn't do just whatever we wanted and treat our workers just like disposable pieces of machinery. So the UAW, at that point, the first time GM said, we're moving a plant to Alabama, they should have said, we're calling a general strike if you do that. We'll stop auto production in the United States unless you keep every single plant in the North and California where they had plants as well. That's it. Deal with that, MF.
There you go.
And at that time, the UAW had the power probably to do it, but they said, I don't know what their thinking was at the time. In the meantime, as somebody said earlier in the show, that everything has been completely globalized. And so to think that auto production is going to come back here, why should it? Why should it?
Yeah.
Unless we could put up tariff barriers. And we don't want tariff barriers, do we? Again, careful with the pronouns here, because we do not include, like you and me and the people listening, don't include the owners of the auto industry. It's we and they. And what they want is the globalization of production, the globalization, the easy movement of capital throughout the world. What we have an interest in, we had an interest in keeping jobs here. So what if we would have had enormous tariff barriers? Well, then what? Guess what? The importations wouldn't have occurred. We wouldn't have had cheap products coming from overseas. But that's all gone. All right. What else? An Iowa egg farmer and a history of salmonella. That's your home state. Not trying to put that off on you, but this one guy was responsible for the Austin J. DeCoster. What do they call him? What's his nickname? Andy or something like that?
I can't remember.
Anyway.
Yeah, you probably saw this on the news. There was a huge egg outbreak. They pulled him off the shelves, and he's one of the largest producers in the country, right?
He almost created salmonella. The epidemic first appeared in New England 50 years ago, and he was the largest egg producer there. And he said, I apologize, and if we hurt anybody on... So why would anybody do this? Why would they allow, there was 500 people who became sick. Nine people died. And unfortunately, there's close connections between DeCoster's egg empire and the spread of salmonella in the United States. And it hasn't really been looked at. Now, these teabaggers that want to get government off our back, how about that? You want food inspection?
Absolutely.
Yeah, how about we'll just let the free market take care of that? Some of these people, they don't want a minimum wage. They don't want laws against child labor.
You got to remember that these are the same people. By the way, we were talking at the beginning of the show how they were being critical of the health plan that's beginning to click in. These were the same people that were against Medicare. They said this was socialism. This was going to destroy the medical profession. It was going to raise insurance for the rest of us sky high. Is that there were tons of private ways that elderly people, retirees, could get their medical care, and it was all panic. It was all
just like this.
Mm-hmm. Then Social Security. Guess what they said? It's socialism. It's communism. It's going to bankrupt the country. And then also Roosevelt put in the minimum wage. That guess what they said? This is, you know, the record is not broken, folks, but it is with these teabaggers are simply the contemporary manifestation of these right wingers that do the bidding work of corporations
and want to keep everything as is.
They want to conserve things as it is. They're conservatives, so they want to conserve the medical system exactly as it is. It gives great service if you're well positioned within the system. If you're not, you're screwed. What do they estimated something like over 40,000 people a year die in the United States because they don't get proper health care or health care soon enough.
Shameful.
Or is that awful President Bush said that everybody's got great medical care. When they get sick, they can go to an emergency room.
Yeah, thanks a lot. How about preventative health care?
Yeah, well.
I want to call them a name right there, but I'm rising above.
Well, so I don't get it, and they become real quiet when that occurs. Now it's interesting that they ask people in this poll. I saw this on this one right wing news site that sometimes has interesting things. They said 35% of the people wish Bush was still president, and I went, wow, you know,
really
in the Soviet Union, in Russia, you know, when the Soviet Union disintegrated, there was probably a third of the people that wished Stalin was back. I mean, they did.
Mm-hmm.
They did. And so I read this article. I said, how in the world, what kind of people would want Bush back? I mean, this guy got us into these wars, killed, you know, wind up killing hundreds of thousands of U.S. soldiers and Afghans
war
and
criminal.
Iraqi. Yeah, yeah. And ruined the economy, drove us into recession, and these people want him back.
Well, he did exactly what Osama bin Laden wanted him to do.
Yeah.
He did exactly what it, and Osama bin Laden, he gave it to him. He got exactly what he wanted, which was to ruin the economy in the United States. It all happened.
We pulled in $2.74 trillion less during the eight Bush years, and if income taxes stayed at the 2000 level.
Yeah. Clinton had that budget balanced. Bush screwed it all up.
Yeah.
It's pretty simple.
So it turned out, though, when I read this, it says 52% of Americans say they'd rather have Obama than his predecessors versus 35% who prefer to have the former President Bush in charge.
Mm. Wow. Shudder to think.
He's gone up a little. It once was his popularity was 23%.
Yeah.
You always wonder, who were those 23%? The 12% must have been their friends.
Yeah.
Okay, we're out of here. I want to thank all of you for listening and for calling. Stephanie, thank you so much for
doing the phones
and so much more and providing us with those very wonderful
interviews and podcasts. Oh, and the muffins.
Oh, yeah, and she's doing the podcast. It'll be up by noon today. And stay tuned. We'll be interviewing Jeff Foe. He's the founder of the Economic Policy Institute. Talk a little more about jobs and why we ain't got them.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
That's the sound of people throwing out their old dehumidifiers. They've replaced them with the energy-saving Wave Ventilation Unit. Wave Ventilation expels moisture, gases, and toxins trapped in your basement or crawl space and replaces it with drier, fresher air. The computerized Wave Ventilation requires no maintenance. There are no buckets to empty, no filters to change. And compared to a dehumidifier, it will save you hundreds of dollars a year in energy costs. One customer wrote,
I was stunned by the difference. I had a dehumidifier for almost 20 years without ever getting rid of that musty smell. And now that smell is finally gone.
Wave can transform your home into a drier, healthier environment. Satisfaction guaranteed. Find out more about Wave ventilation right now. For free information, go to goodairnow.com. That's goodairnow.com. Or call 1-866-324-9481. That's 1-866-324-9481.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Well, we're really being buffeted, aren't we, as a nation, as a state, by the economy. We're told that the recession has ended, but there's going to be extended unemployment. It's hit us so hard here in Michigan, and it's really difficult to make sense of all of this. Are things going well, like we're told in some quarters, or are they headed straight downward, as we're told from other people? And it's not always left and right. I mean, there's some people on the left that say we're going to hell in a handbasket, and I guess everybody on the right says we are. One of the ways that I always find out is check in with people that have made a lifetime of studying such trends in economics, how it relates to political policy. One very valuable person who's been on the show previously is Jeff Foe. He's the founding president, now distinguished fellow at the Economic Policy Institute. It's the Economic Policy Institute. Jeff Foe founded that in 1986. And Jeff has worked as an economist in the Department of State, Labor, and Commerce, a manager in the finance industry, and this is what I love, a blueberry farmer and a member of a municipal planning board in the state of Maine. He's also written 5 books. The latest was The Global Class War. You may remember Jeff Foe from when he was on this show then. He's also got a new book he's working on America's future. We reach him at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington at his office. Jeff Foe, thanks for returning to the Peter Werby Show.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Yeah, I don't know why I'm most interested in you as a blueberry farmer, because I go to Maine frequently.
Everybody's interested in that. Yes, it's true. I raised blueberries for about 11 years in Maine, and it was quite an experience, I can tell you that.
Well, I just think of eating a Maine blueberry pie on the dock in Port Clyde, Maine, at the Dipnet. I don't know if your blueberries ever got there, but they were delicious. All right, let's get down to what we really want to talk about, and that's our economy. You say that you're started a new book on America's future. That's a quite an undertaking. I mean, it looks so foggy to me. Are you making sense of all this?
Well, nobody knows what's coming, of course. But you can figure out the trajectory of this country. That is, if we continue to do what we're doing and don't accept the signals of where we're going, the future is not bright. We sort of know this. The polls show that people think that the next generation is going to be worse off than the current one. Polls think that China is going to surpass the United States. But I don't think that the depth of what we're facing really has gotten through to certainly to the body politic. I mean, this campaign is really all about fluff and margin and posturing. The question of where we want this country to go, what kind of a future do we want, which used to be part of the political debate in America, is really off the table. And so we end up with a kind of discussion, I wouldn't call it a discussion, but kind of an argument over things that most people understand are not crucial to the nation. And so they get turned off by politics. The tragedy is, of course, you get turned off by politics, you stay at home, and you have no influence at all on what's going to happen to this country or to you. And I think that that's you know, we still have this sense, and the polls show it, that, well, the country may go to hell in a handbag, but I'll be all right. The world doesn't quite work like that way. If our country goes, we all go with it.
Yeah. Jeff Foe is my guest. He's a distinguished fellow at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. The website is epi.org. Jeff Foe is going to be in Detroit this Tuesday, September 28th, 7 p.m. at the McGregor Conference Center at Wayne State University. It's a free forum, and it's called The Job Crisis. How did it happen? How long will it last? What can we do to solve it? I would suspect, and this goes to what you're saying, Jeff, if the world made any sense, there would be 20,000 people at this, given the economy of Detroit and Michigan. Instead, people, and maybe this is what you're getting at, we all want to know, did Christine McDonald use her money, her campaign money, to pay her rent or not? I mean, why are people seemingly so unable to face what is critical to their lives and our lives?
Well, I think there's several reasons for that. One is just the culture that we live in, the immediate gratification, fast answers, glib conversations that last a very short time on TV, the soundbite culture makes it, you know, very difficult for people to get into an extended conversation. And, of course, it's all commercial, and that is, you know, the media of this country is in business to make money, and it tends to appeal to the lowest common denominator. But I think there's something, in a way, more important, and that is that the political system that we've got, we have a two-party system. And so we're supposed to have these polarized discussions, but they're supposed to be on substance. And I think one of the things that has happened over the last 20 years or so is that money has become number one, number two, and number three in importance to politicians. All of the discussion about policies and really are floating on a sea of money. And, you know, this there's no country that's perfect in the world, but at least in most of the other advanced countries, there's a limited amount of time when you campaign. There are restrictions on spending. We have none of that. And so we have this continuous campaign that's being funded by people for whom the system works just fine. And it gets really shocking. You know, one of the reasons that America has always rebounded in the past is because while we've always had class issues and class conflict in this country, everybody, the people at the top and the people at the bottom, were stuck here in America. And so we had to accommodate ourselves to each other. And while we had differences, there was a sense that we had a common destiny. You look around today at the managers of what we call American corporations, and by their own words, I mean, this is no conspiracy, hidden conspiracy, by their own words, they will tell you that they don't consider themselves an American corporation. When they're in America, yes, they're American. When they're in Germany, they're German. When they're in China, they're Chinese. And so that the elite of America has been slowly and increasingly disconnecting its future from that of the country. I was shocked when I read a little while ago a statement by the CEO of Cisco Systems. Now, Cisco Systems, after Microsoft, is the most important producer, quote, American, unquote, producer of high technology information systems here. The CEO of Cisco Systems said publicly that their strategy is to become a Chinese company. Now, you know, this is This is, and it's open. It's not, as I say, there's no conspiracy here. And so what you've got is something that's quite different than we've ever had in the lifetime of this republic. And that is the governing class, if you will, becoming less convinced that their future lies here in America. And so, and yet, you know, there's no, so the bias of the news, which is about important people, right? I mean, that's what the media reports, is the opinions of important people, which, in my view, are increasingly not interested in the future of this country. Now, that doesn't mean they're not as patriotic in many ways as the next person, but in terms of their corporate identities and what they do every day in their job, America's future is no more important to them than the future of China.
Jeff O is my guest. He's a founding president and distinguished fellow at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. And we're talking, at least in the beginning portion here of our talk, about a new book on America's future. Now, there's some people that have said that it's inexorable, this movement of capital, just like the movement of capital has been pretty much unstoppable since it first came on the political economic scene, wherever you dated from 6,000 years ago or 400 years ago, and that we have to ride with globalization. But if we're selling our labor in a free market, we might as well just all thatch our roofs, right? I mean,
well, there are several pieces to that question. One is, yes, capital has always been restless and wants to go where the profits are greatest. But from the beginning of this country until quite recently, it was accepted by the leadership of both parties that there was a responsibility to keep that under control. In Washington today, the word industrial policy will get you a snicker. And the smart money says, well, you know, what do we care if the manufacturing leaves the United States? Well, we did care for 200 years, and that's what built America into an industrial power. Alexander Hamilton wrote a report in the late 18th century called A Report on Manufactures, where he laid out a program, a plan that lasted for more than 100 years of government guidance and assistance to developing a strong manufacturing base in the United States. It was later called the American System by Henry Clay in the 1830s and embraced by Abraham Lincoln. And ironically, this government industrial policy to expand manufacturing in America was the policy of the Republican Party in the 19th century, and that was the time when we rose to world power as an industry. So our history is full of democratically elected government guiding, channeling, moving investment from one place to another to assure that progress occurs in the United States, that the good jobs are here, and that the technology that we need as we go into the future is here at home. And all of that stopped in the 1980s. I mean, partly it was the election of Ronald Reagan, but that's not the whole story. And it's interesting that after World War II, of course, we ended up as the major manufacturer in the world. And I think what happened is somehow we assumed that that was the God-ordained natural order of things. And as we started to slip, beginning in the 1970s, And when the when we had that first those three energy crises in the 1970s, which showed that the United States no longer controlled the oil in the world, the oil that we used to fuel our manufacturing, our automobile industry, et cetera, that Jimmy Carter, of all people, and independently Ted Kennedy, and independently some business people, started to develop proposals for long-term economic planning for the United States. Richard Nixon and Dwight Eisenhower were interested in this. And of course, you know that Carter saw the energy problem back in the late 1970s and tried to develop a long-term plan for making us less dependent on imported oil. That was stopped dead after the election of Ronald Reagan and mocked.
Yeah.
And
who famously, when he came into office, took the solar panels off
of, that's right,
off the White House. First thing he did.
And while, you know, I was around at that time, and I was somewhat critical of some of Carter's proposals. But, boy, looking back, you see that if we had gone down that road and we had, you know, there would have been successes and failures and mistakes. But we would be so far ahead of where we are now had we kept up this notion that the government, the people through its government, have some responsibility for shaping the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me reintroduce you. Jeff Foe is my guest. He's the founding president and a distinguished fellow now at the Economic Policy Institute. The website is epi.org. Jeff Foe is going to be in Detroit on Tuesday, September 28th, 7 p.m. at the McGregor Conference Center at Wayne State University, and going to speak on the subject of the jobs crisis. How did it happen? How long will it last? And what can we do to solve it? Actually, now that I'm thinking, those are good questions that I haven't asked you yet. You're listening to The Peter Werbe Show, and you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Go to the calendar section. It'll give you all the information about the talk. Also, I suspect at epi.org, there'll be a listing there. Bob King, the newly elected UAW president, has talked about taking on these economic issues about jobs and talks about bringing back industry, talks about bringing back unions, and a great person. I mean, tremendous that he happened along at this time, because your last book, The Global Class War, which has been all one-sided, Bob King suddenly says the middle class and the working class have to start fighting. The war is only on the side of the industrialists and the corporate heads and what have you. But there are other people on the left, people like, I don't know if you're familiar with Grace Lee Boggs, who says the unions aren't coming back. The industry isn't coming back. We even have to stop talking about jobs. We have to just start talking about, in some ways, pretty rudimentary work to how do we create a human community on the skeleton of what was industrial society here in Detroit. I mean, that's pretty dystopian, but the last question of your talk, how do we solve it? Is it solvable, or should we buy that thatch for our roofs?
Well, I don't know the future, neither does she. And there are lots of examples from history when we thought the world was going one way and it turned out to go the other way. I don't think the question is about guessing, what the future is going to be like. We have to go back to this fundamental question of guiding the future and shaping it. And the way you shape it in a modern economy is through investment. Investment shapes the future, right? That's the forward-looking economic behavior. And one of the most interesting things for me, and it relates to how we got into this crisis, is that before the deregulation of finance began in the 1980s, the function of banks were to provide capital for an investment, which is, again, shaping the future, to the non-bank sector, to the producing sector, people who were producing goods and services, mostly goods, for really shaping the future. And when the banking system got deregulated, suddenly the bankers, instead of making loans and providing capital for the plans for the future from business, they started providing the capital to themselves. Now,
for investment, for speculative
for
investment.
Speculation.
Yeah.
Now, the
yeah.
financial system, the Wall Street, is by its very nature not future oriented. Not future oriented in the sense that a normal person would think of it. For them, it's buy a stock at 10:30 and sell it at 11. Now, that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but it's also a little bit of an exaggeration on both sides. The latest technology in Wall Street provides for transactions that can be made within 11 seconds. So you have, over the last 30 years, what's happened is that investment money, capital, which is what shapes the future, has been shifted to this short-term casino, and we all know the results of that. The results of that is that the United States no longer has been produced or is growing its production of goods. We rely on more and more imports, but it has been accelerating its production of what the finance industry produces, and that's debt.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's no surprise that if you sort of look at the future and look what the components of the future are, that we're low on investment and we're high on debt. And clearly that shift to banks and financial companies used to have about one third of the total corporate debt in America. Now they have almost all of it, and the result, of course, is that business and investment in America has been defined as getting rich on Wall Street. We know that the smart kids coming out of our top colleges over the last 20 years have not gone into engineering and science and design work and things of that sort, but they all want to go to Wall Street to get rich.
Jeff, we have about 2 minutes.
We've just had is a result of that.
Yeah, we have about 2 minutes left. And
is that all?
Yes. I mean, because, well, that's why you're giving a talk on Tuesday, September 28th at Wayne State, and I'll give all the details in just a minute that you can flesh this out a lot more, because this all barely scratches the surface, and I hope that this piques people's interest to learn about this fully. But we began talking some about the elections and the two-party system and what have you, and I was reading an article in the Detroit News that said that the people that are tending to vote for the Republicans the most are people that have been unemployed for 6 months or more. In other words, they were hoping, that Barack Obama and Governor Jennifer Granholm were going to solve the problems. The problems haven't been solved to the extent that it's ameliorated their personal problem. So now they're going to, the Democrats didn't work. Let's go to the Republicans. And then after a while, of course, the Republicans won't do it. And so we do have sort of a merry-go-round effect without really having fundamental policy that changes things.
Well, part of the problem is that many voters have not taken the time to really think through the economic situation. Now, you can't expect everybody to be an economist. It's a good thing. But changing from one leader to another, from one party to another, is a sort of blind way to go about doing your duty as a citizen. What has happened over the last couple of years has been a tremendous economics lesson. And the one thing it shows is that the notion that we can balance the budget, cut taxes, deregulate banking and not pay any attention to our manufacturing is a disaster. And as I read the plan by John Boehner this morning, the Republican House leader, it's exactly that. It's exactly going back to the kinds of policies that put us in the soup in the first place. That doesn't mean that the Democrats have all the answers, because they don't, and Barack Obama's made a lot of mistakes. But to blindly just turn around and say, well, this guy didn't do it for me, I'll take the next guy, without looking at what those people are saying, can continue the kind of downward slide this country's going on.
All right. Let me just remind people again, my guest, Jeff Foe, who is now a distinguished fellow at the Economic Policy Institute. There's a lot of think tanks in Washington, right, with a combination of those words. But this is the Economic Policy Institute. It's epi.org. And Jeff Foe will be in town Tuesday, September 28th, 7 p.m. at the McGregor Conference Center at Wayne State University. It's free. The jobs crisis is what it's called. How did it happen? And how long will it last? What can we do to solve it? This is important for all of us. You can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E. Look for the calendar in the left-hand column. It'll give you that same information that I just gave you. Jeff Foe, as usual, thanks for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Did you see today's Motor City Daily Deal? $85 in spa services for only $29?
Yes. I got my Motor City Daily Deal email first thing this morning. I've already bought mine.
I'm buying mine now and sending it to Jen. We've been thinking about trying the salon. It's like a 65% savings.
Make sure to remind her that Motor City Daily Deal is only available for 24 hours. She has to get it before it's too late.
Absolutely. What do you think tomorrow's Motor City Daily Deal will be?
Maybe that Italian restaurant in Utica that Jen's mentioned. Or what about that bakery in Livonia?
I hope it's that rib place in Commerce. Now I can't wait to get tomorrow's Motor City Daily Deal email.
Me too.
MotorCityDailyDeal.com. You get an email each day with one incredible deal, saving you as much as 85%. But it's available for only one day. Sign up and get the savings. MotorCityDailyDeal.com. That's MotorCityDailyDeal.com.
Time's running out. You're maxed out on your credit cards. The collection calls are coming every day. And now you're two payments behind on your mortgage. Every time you turn on the radio, there's some cheerful couple telling you how they got out of debt overnight. Their stress is gone, and everything's just wonderful. Come on. The truth is, what sounds too good to be true is too good to be true. You need real help, and you need it now. Not bankruptcy. That should be your last choice. We're Credit Card Relief, and we've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. We're the attorney-driven program, dedicated to helping you get out of debt in months instead of years, saving you thousands, and without risking your family home. We know what we're doing, and we don't make promises we can't keep. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Get out of debt. Call Credit Card Relief at 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. That's Credit Card Relief. 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282. If you want a new computer but think you can't get credit, think again. Just call Tronix Country right now. No matter what your credit status is, now you can own a brand new desktop or laptop computer. Your approval is guaranteed, as long as you have an active checking account and can afford small weekly payments. With Tronix Country, there's no credit check. You will not be turned down. Call right now and order your new computer. You'll also get a free color printer and a free digital camera. Just call 800-990-2258. But that's not all. Call right now and you'll also get a free 22-inch high-definition TV with your paid purchase. You heard right. A free TV with your new computer. All you need is an active checking account and your approval is guaranteed. Don't wait. Call Tronix Country right now. Call 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. I should give you the little bit of the history of the interview we're about to commence with, and that's with Andrei Codrescu, probably best known to a lot of you as the NPR commentator, but also an award-winning poet, a novelist, an essayist, and he edits the online journal Exquisite Corpse. We started an interview yesterday, and we were recording it, and in typical Andrei Codrescu, Peter Werby style, Andrei was in an alley in New Orleans, and he was shepherding around some writers from Romania. It turned out, though, just didn't work out because of the sound quality. But we have him back. I think he's out of the alley. Andrei, you're no longer in the alley, are you?
No, it's a pleasure to talk to you, Peter. I'm in my friend, poet Dave Brink's house, which is completely filled with poetry books. Top to bottom, it's amazing.
Well, I should tell you, your creds, which you richly deserve, you taught literature and creative writing at Louisiana State University for 25 years before retiring in 2009. You were the McCurdy Distinguished Professor of English. Your most recent work includes The Post-Human Dada Guide and also Jealous Witness Poems, your brand new book. It's called The Poetry Lesson, and it's published by Princeton, as was The Post-Human Dada Guide, which I should have interviewed you about that, but maybe we can weave this all in together. You know, I started the interview that didn't happen with the statement that many, maybe even most people, think they don't like poetry. Do you think that's the case?
Well, it is the case, because they are being taught in school that it's something frightening, that and then they think they can't understand it, and they don't like to memorize it, and their teachers don't really know that poetry is not just stuff on the page, but it's a way of living, and it has something to do with our deep psyche and with how we're going to be in the future, and how really poems are going to be the new currency. You know, the dollar is not doing too good, so how about poems, folks? I'll give you 5 poems for that thing, whatever it is.
Well, you're going to have trouble getting a car. You'd have to, but you've written so many. And people, we should tell people, and people may remember from the many times you've been on this program, Andrei Codrescu, but you actually landed here in Detroit many, many moons ago. When was it, like 1966 or something like that?
Yeah, I had a good luck, actually, to land in Detroit in 1966, which was a big year of changes in the United States, so all over the world, really. And in Detroit, I had the good luck to go to the Writers and Poets Workshop that John Sinclair was running at the time, music and poetry and all sorts of creative spirits attracted to it. So I was introduced very quickly to what came to be known as the alternative American culture, but which I think is really the American culture now. So, yeah, Detroit was very good for me. And it was a tough city, so I didn't know, because I came from a small, poor communist country. It was tough in a way that made me ready for the rest of America. So when I went to San Francisco, New York, and the rest of them, I thought, oh, well, these places are easy compared to Detroit. I'm a veteran now.
Well, remind us, too, about, as you say, some of your history leaving Romania. And I always have to ask, you have told me the difference about 9 times, the difference between Romania and Romania. Which is the preferential one?
Well, the correct OED spelling now is R-O, R-O, R-O,
okay.
Romania.
Yeah. I would have guessed wrong. Okay.
Well, you know, I mean, they try to trace themselves to the Latins, you know, it's a little bit of national hubris.
Yeah, and you wrote a wonderful account of the Romanian Revolution. See how my memory's doing. The Hole in the Flag, wasn't that the name of it?
Yeah, NPR and ABC News gave me this assignment to cover, quote-unquote, what was going on in Romania in 1989. So I went over there with the intention of writing about the events, but I really want to kind of recover my childhood, because I hadn't been back for 25 years. So I went around smelling things, which is not what they paid me for, and visiting friends, old friends. So it turned out to be a quite powerful experience. And, of course, they're still shooting at us, which made it journalism.
Well, I remember, too, at least one of your culinary adventures. You were then, at least, a vegetarian?
Yeah, I was a vegetarian, and my good friends decided to have a feast in my honor, so they slaughtered the family pig, and they cooked it in various wonderful Romanian ways. And so, I mean, there was absolutely no way for me to say, well, I don't eat meat. because the it was a sacrifice, and so I ate, and I thought that was pretty terrific, so I gave up this particular.
You know, I actually forgot.
Affection.
I forgot, since I've been to Cuba three times as a journalist, and I just remembered. I have a book of yours about your trip to Cuba, and that was when? In the early 90s, wasn't it?
That was in the 96 or 97. It was just before the Pope went to Cuba, and the Cubans produced their only touristic piece of kitsch, which was a T-shirt with the Pope and Fidel shaking hands. I think I still have that somewhere. And, yeah, we were lucky enough to go before the World Press did, because then everyone went to Cuba to cover the Pope, and then the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke in the middle of that, and they all left Cuba, so all those stories were untold. So we were lucky there, too.
Well, just watch how this that little piece floats into your brand new book, your latest, The Poetry Lesson by Andrei Codrescu. When the Pope came to Hamtramck in Detroit, these entrepreneurs put out a T-shirt honoring him with his photograph, and it said "Viva la Papa," because they wanted to put "la." Of course, you know that means "Hooray for the potato."
Yeah, that's really for the Pope. Yeah, that's Polish for the Pope, I guess.
All right, well, your book, The Poetry Lesson, and this is how this all ties in. On the cover, there is a skeleton in the traditional prayer mode. On the skeleton's on its knees, the skull is looking upwards, and the hands in a prayerful shape. How does that announce the poetry lesson?
Well, that's the archetype of poetry predicament, which is that we are in a funny, I'm not funny, but in a relationship with death, and the fact that we'd like our poems to survive us because we know we won't. So we, you know, our bones are prayerfully directed towards something, which is, you know, the hope that our poems will last.
Well, tell us some about your poetry classes. Again, you know, there would be, I'm trying to think. You know, on one hand, there's the business administration majors that are these tough entrepreneurs, probably play a lot of touch football. And then you would think the stereotype would be the wispy kids, the bohemian kids, the latter-day hippies, and all that. Is there a stereotype of someone that signed up, because you're not teaching it anymore, Andrei Codrescu's poetry class at Louisiana State University?
Yeah, I had all kinds of students. Some of them were taking the class because it was an English requirement, because the book, actually, which amused me hugely, was written after class, because I would have a seminar from 3 to 6, and then I would go to the coffee house and write about my students. Of course, they didn't know about it, and I had huge amounts of fun. And some of them were business majors, and I had an ROTC girl who came in uniform who turned out to be extremely cool. And we discussed a great number of issues, and I made, I gave them poets, dead poets, to read and research and be their ghost companions, is what I called it, and consult their poets in all the matters that concern their lives, including what to have for lunch. I said, well, if you have a question, just open the book and the poet will answer it. And so I matched them with ghost companions whose last name started the same letters as theirs. And so Miss Pritchett from, I think, that was her name, from ROTC, got Ezra Pound. Hmm. And so she read the great Ezra Pound violent anti-war poem about World War One, and and she understood immediately. People have a hard time understanding Pound, but she understood that this poem was violently opposed to that madness, and so it created both tension and real discussion.
Well, someone, people might say, and I mean, to me, I guess the answer is obvious, but I should just pose it. Some people might say, why have poetry in a manner that takes interpretation or isn't 100% clear or just seems to be the musings of the imagery of the writer, when you could just write it all out? Because you write novels, you write essays that are clear as a bell. I mean, actually, your poetry is as well. But other poets, you scratch your head, like our friend Rick London, who you know, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he was writing what was called language poetry, and I'm thinking,
nothing here that I can even hold on to. Why not just, if you're trying to say something, why not just say it straight out would be the American way?
Well, poetry, marginal as it is actually a contentious place. There are all kinds of aesthetics fighting each other. But, you know, it's like life has many confused and gray areas and things we don't know about. And that I think poetry, if it's any good, tries to get at things that are both mysterious and inexplicable. And because most of what we do and feel is not easy to understand. And, I mean, poetry is just one way, one very strange way to get at something that has to do both with language and with living. But it's, you know, it's not something you can put a value on, which is why it's a kind of art that's very hard to incorporate in a humanities program in a university or in anything else, because you can't really say what it is, and that's actually its power, you know. But you're right that some poets refuse to make sense. I mean, you simply refuse to. I mean, instead, refuse to make sense because a lot of life doesn't, and I think that in a way they're using language to imitate that same process, or at least, you know, try to make sense of it by nonsense. I mean, it's a paradox, but it's true. You can write something that you don't understand, but it'll capture you like music does. You know, I mean, New Orleans, where I am now, is a place that everyone, that music is permeated by music. And so you can have a poet read something that nobody understands, because they will understand it the way they understand music. They don't get the words, but they feel something.
Hmm. The book is The Poetry Lesson. My guest is Andrei Codrescu, the a poet, novelist, essayist, and NPR commentator. You're listening to The Peter Werbe Show. I mentioned, we're probably really off in obscurantist land talking about language poetry, but it leads me actually to a thought. I mean, poets have routinely been shot by authoritarian regimes, and I remember an explanation of this very, very difficult to understand language poetry, say its intent was to subvert the historic confidence of the bourgeoisie. In other words, it was an assault on the dominant middle-class culture. Does poetry have that power?
I think it does. Well, certainly the authoritarian regimes think it does. And some of our best readers were the censors, who read very carefully. They read our poems more carefully than other readers, because it contained seditious things. But it also had to do with the superstition of in Romania, the communists, about print. They began their movement and their ideology in the print shop. And so there was a direct connection to writing a pamphlet and writing anything else. Anything printed that could be distributed was suspect, and it was inspected very closely. Now, in our country, in our system, where nobody pays any attention to skinny books of poems, it also has a subversive quality, because it will frustrate the consumer who wants to hear something clear. They want to hear an opinion. They want to hear a CNN-like point of view that's very clear, and he makes a political or social statement. Well, poetry that refuses to do that will baffle and annoy your average bourgeois, even if he's enrolled in the class.
Were you ever censored, either academically in Romania or any point where your poems were suppressed?
Yeah, well, in Romania I was censored, as a matter of fact, and really? I had a number of works that just didn't get published because they didn't get past the censor. Our kind of censorship is economic, and the book publishing is in trouble right now, and all the best books of poetry and fiction are published by small and independent presses, because the mainstream presses won't take any chances on anything that doesn't have the chance of ending up on Oprah or get some hype machine going behind it. So the best books are by small publishers. And they don't censor, but in some way they also don't edit. And so there is a difference between censorship and editing. And, you know, we lack editors in the sense of people who read very carefully, and they'll say, well, this just is weak. You know, I mean, there are aesthetic criteria for publishing books and for writing stuff.
Andre Codescu, you taught creative writing for 25 years at Louisiana State University, and I'm sure, having lived in Detroit and San Francisco, been in New York for a long time as well, that the kind of prejudices we have against the South, right, and we think of them as kind of a notch lower in intellect than those of us in the enlightened North. Any truth to that?
Yeah, well, I take issue with that all the time, because I think you've got just as many bigots in the North as you do in the South. And the fact is that the small communities, that I know in the South actually have exactly the same percentage of thinking people to idiots that every place else does. So I think the South has a bum rap because people here are quite thoughtful, you know. And I think, for instance, the Tea Party, which is making waves now, is an old American strain of know-nothings and of saying no to all kinds of things. And I don't think it's unhealthy. I think it's just this perennial expression of this American rebellion that comes out, and it doesn't know what it's about, but it is real. So We pay attention to those people, not so much. I mean, we pay attention both as entertainment, which I'm sure everybody does, but also because they seem to focus on various kinds of anger. You know, some of it political, some of it audible, some of it maybe they're angry because they don't understand poetry.
Hmm. Well, you know, there's the prejudice that the late Lenny Bruce, the comic, talked about. He said if Einstein would have had a Southern accent and come in and said, howdy, y'all, I have this here theory of relativity, they would have kicked him right out. Whereas if you have a Romanian accent or an English accent, it's actually almost valued. You suspect immediately there's little something more there, which is probably nuts, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, Louisiana is a little different because I've been asked a number of times, what part of Louisiana are you from? Because there are so many accents here. In other places, they ask me where I'm from, and I say Romania, and that takes a little while to register because nobody knows where it is. But, you know, in general, I find that people do have some kind of respect or listen better if you talk funny. On the other hand, we live now in a period of extreme paranoia about immigration and so on. So to have an accent almost means that you're an illegal alien. So
wow.
I suddenly find myself in this very odd, you know, I have the feeling that everybody wants to ask me for my green card, you know, and I do have it. It's my middle finger.
I was gonna say, as long as they're not asking what part of Mexico are you from when they hear you. My guest on the Peter Werby Show, Andre Codrescu, he's written his latest book, is The Poetry Lesson, and it's published by Princeton University. You can, just go to press.princeton.edu. We should tell people about that. You have your own website as well, right?
Yeah, I have codrescu.com, and then there is the corpse.org. ORG, CorpseORG, corpse.org, which is the journal website, and there is information there too about the book and also about this utopian community that may or may not happen with houses built from books. It's a new idea, and I'm right now talking to a lot of architects about how to make bricks from books by making them humidity proof and so on. So,
you mean just like old books that are getting to be sort of historic curios?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I know someone who can get books by the ton, cheap.
Yeah. Huh.
And they are books that have never been read or that they were bestsellers in their time and nobody's going to read them again. What gave me the idea was that we had millions and millions of hardback copies of the Fathers of Communism printed in Romania for 40 years, which were part of the furniture of every apparatchik's office, but nobody ever read them. And the Romanian artist made a fountain out of them, and with mirrors and polyurethane the books, and then put mirrors on the bottom, so they look infinite. And so I realized that there are millions of books out there that could be returned to the forest, you know, or to building. Wow.
We only have a few minutes left. Let's just talk about a little about your writing. When you wrote the poetry lesson, on reading it, of course, it just looks like a lot of fun. I know two writers, at least, that they've been writing books for years. They're just agonizing. One of them says, "Why did I ever start this?"
That's Detroit, man. It snows there.
So when you write something like the poetry lesson, is it a labor of love, or is it just, I don't know. What?
No, it is a labor of love, and it's a labor of joy, because to me personally, it doesn't make sense to agonize over words. I think they should come from a place of ecstatic pleasure. I mean, it should be a pleasurable activity, and if it's not, it should be cured in other ways. Go get a drink or take a Xanax or something.
Well, yeah, it's obvious from the work you've done throughout a lifetime that you have a head full of ideas. I mean, there's the Bob Dylan line: "I have a head full of ideas that are driving me insane." But so, when you have an idea, how does it manifest itself in poetry or in a novel or in an essay, or you say, "Gee, I want to get this out on NPR as a commentary"? Is there something that drives you to one form or another?
Well, there is something. The ideas do come sort of demanding a way to a form, and I think, you know, the essays do that, and sometimes the line will come, and it's obviously poetry, so I quickly whip out my iPhone and I write it down, and then later I look at it. But it's an act of joy, and it's really just the main reason for it is to spread happiness, you know. And if I'm going to depress more people, I would rather not do it.
You know, you may or may not remember this. You gave me a manuscript back so far ago. I must have been 4 or 5 years old. It was so long ago. That you brought with you from Romania, and it had every single, there was no margins on the top or the bottom or the sides. And I think you told me that it was hard to get paper in Romania. And so, I mean, the amount of difficulty this must have all taken on a manual typewriter, now we just, you can, you know, knock this out while you're sitting in a cafe. Has the electronics, the technology made writing any easier for you?
Well, you know, it's funny, Peter, because in addition to, you know, the manual typewriter, I only type with one finger.
Huh?
And so, you know, it really was difficult. But the technology and the new media has made it wonderfully possible to not just to write, but to send it out quickly. Because in the old days, it took a year to publish a book. That's how long it took the process. And now if you have a stupid or brilliant idea, you can tweet it into the universe, and it goes out there very quickly. It's very satisfying to me, and I think that this, you know, we enter more and more the age of social networks. It has its drawbacks, but one of them is not sending out your poetry. I think it's been a blessing for all of us writers, plus the fact that we don't have to use all that paper.
No, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much. You've taught at Louisiana State University for 25 years. This frees you all up. Golf?
Poets never rest, you know. And actually, they just let me slide. I have no idea how where time went, you know. But I still have friends I made over the years.
Well, okay, thank you, and I would highly recommend this delightful book. It's The Poetry Lesson by Andre Codrescu. The last name is Codrescu. If you're writing in your car, don't try to write it down. You can go to my website, Peter Werbe. Of course, the last name's not that easy either, Werbe. And the brand-new book is The Poetry Lesson. It's published by Princeton. Andre, as usual, thanks for being on the show.
Peter, it's always wonderful to be on your show and to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Rib Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Do you owe back taxes to the IRS that you can't afford to pay? Or are you stuck in a tax payment plan that's getting you nowhere? The IRS is now taking very aggressive actions, such as bank levies and wage garnishments. If you owe the IRS at least $15,000, call American Tax Relief. They've helped thousands of people like you eliminate up to 85% of their delinquent taxes. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, American Tax Relief can settle your tax debts for less than you owe, remove penalties and interest, and protect you from bank levies and garnishments. As a hardworking American, you do have rights. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation and see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, you can save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Call right now. 1-800-493-8159. That's 1-800-493-8159.
Water is all around us. No wonder it's hard to imagine we're facing a water crisis. But we are. So that's why the American Planning Association brings you simple ways to save water at home and in your community. Learn more at planning.org. That's planning.org. A public service message from this station and the American Planning Association.
101 The Riff.
Energy Hog the team! I want you to infiltrate the house and waste some energy!
We'll just sneak into these leaky windows!
Just like we thought, boss! No insulation in the attic!
Perfect! Now go wild and waste some wattage!
The Mitchell House. A house like many others. Except this one's under attack by energy hogs. They show up anywhere energy's being wasted.
Talk to me, hogs!
Washer, it's not Energy Star rated.
Outstanding! What about the thermostat?
Not programmable. I repeat, not programmable.
Looks like we're living high on the hog.
Only one person has the power to get rid of energy hogs. You.
Hold on! Someone's home!
Andy's got energy-efficient light bulbs!
To find out how you can fight energy hogs, log on to energyhog.org. You'll find fun games and lots of tips on making your home more energy-efficient.
Now he's installing Energy Star appliances!
Not Energy Star! That's it! Get out of there! I'll get you, energyhog.org!
Hey! Wait for me!
Brought to you by the Alliance to Save Energy, the Department of Energy, and the Ad Council.
101.
W-R-I-F.
Yeah! Boom! Remember that?
Everything that rocks. 81 Detroit. The Riff Sin City Takeover. Details at WRIF.com. Exclusively from 101 WRIF. Everything that